England and Australia do battle to compete for the Ashes.
That is extraordinary.
Hear live ball-by-ball commentary on Five Sports Extra and get analysis and reaction of every day's play with the Test Match Special podcast.
The stump's out of the ground.
Test Match Special at the Ashes. Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday the 29th of November. This is Tom Sanders. Good morning. The government is to ban the use of taxis to take asylum seekers to medical appointments after the practice was revealed by a BBC investigation earlier this year. Radio 4's File on 4 investigates found examples including a 250-mile journey to see a GP. Here's our political correspondent Nick Eardley.
The BBC revealed earlier this year that taxis were being used for journeys such as to doctor's appointments, sometimes hundreds of miles away, at an expense of hundreds of pounds. The Home Office announced a review, and now it's been confirmed the use of taxis will be banned from February for medical travel. There will be limited exemptions, including for people with physical disabilities, but these will have to be approved by the Home Office. The government is continuing to review the use of taxis for other travel, like moving people between accommodation. It's also been revealed that the average annual cost of all forms of transport for asylum seekers is £15.8 million.
Airlines are making urgent modifications to thousands of Airbus planes after the firm discovered intense solar radiation could interfere with onboard flight control computers. Passengers have been warned of possible disruption, as Nick Johnson reports.
Last month, a JetBlue flight from Cancun in Mexico to Newark in the United States experienced a sudden drop in altitude. Airbus said radiation from the sun was found to interfere with sensors critical to the aircraft's flight controls. Action is now being taken to prevent a similar incident, with more than 6,000 Airbus planes thought to be vulnerable to the same problem. For many affected aircraft, the issue can be resolved with a straightforward software update. EasyJet says it's already completed the fix and expects to operate normally today. Heathrow and Manchester Airport say they do not expect widespread disruption, while Gatwick says some delays are possible.
3 days of official mourning have begun in Hong Kong after a devastating fire ripped through several tower blocks on Wednesday. Government officials stood outside their headquarters to observe a three-minute silence in memory of the 128 people known to have died. Around 200 others are missing. From Hong Kong, Danny Vincent reports.
Flags at all government offices are flying at half-mast as people across Hong Kong mourn those killed in the world's worst residential building fire in decades. A number of condolence books have been set up throughout the city for people to sign. King Charles has sent a message of support, saying he and the Queen were greatly saddened by what he called an appalling tragedy. The authorities have arrested 11 people in connection with the blaze, with investigators focusing on possible corruption and the unsafe use of building materials.
The authorities in Ukraine say a nighttime Russian drone attack on the capital Kyiv has killed one man and injured several other people. Loud explosions were heard across the city as several apartment blocks were hit. The Trump administration says it's halting all asylum decisions in the wake of the shooting in Washington of two members of the National Guard, one of whom has died. Wednesday's attack has been blamed on an Afghan national. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Writing on social media, the head of the US Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency, Joseph Edlow, said all asylum decisions had been halted until officials could be sure that every alien would be vetted to the maximum degree possible. A short time later, the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, confirmed that no new visas would be issued to people travelling on an Afghan passport. Both announcements come the day after the death of a National Guard soldier, Sarah Beckstrom. The suspected killer is an Afghan national who entered the US in 2021 as part of a program recognizing his service alongside US forces in Afghanistan.
We'll have a look at the papers in a minute, but first the weather forecast, and Elizabeth Rizzini is here. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello. Thank you, Tom. Well, it's much drier and brighter tomorrow if you've got outdoor plans this weekend. Today there's going to be some heavy rain towards the south, and there's actually a Met Office yellow warning in place for heavy rain across England and Wales. Won't be raining all the time, but it's already a wet start to the day across Wales, southwest England, parts of northern England too. This rain is set to drift further eastwards, clearing East Anglia later on through the day. There'll be something drier and brighter developing from the southwest, and perhaps a little bit of snowfall over the Pennines and the Welsh Mountains. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, then it is actually largely dry today. Some rain towards the far southeast of Scotland at times, some showers, a bit wintry over the higher ground, but there should be lots of brightness developing later on through the day. It's quite chilly towards the north, 3 to 8 degrees Celsius here, but milder further south, 7 to 11 degrees Celsius, and a touch of frost for many of us tonight.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Let's have a look at the papers today. Many of them are taking aim at the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, over claims she was told by the OBR that there is no black hole in the public finances well before she unveiled her budget. The Times describes it as a budget of smoke and mirrors, as it focuses on what it calls crippling tax rises in the hospitality sector. With the headline, Liar Reeves Must Go, the Daily Mail tells its readers the Chancellor kept the secret in order to hike taxes. Chancellor of the Exchequer is how the Sun frames the story, while the Daily Telegraph suggests she's fighting for her job, with the headline, Reeves on the Brink over Tax Lies. The Financial Times says the Chancellor has been accused of exaggerating gloom, but reports that Downing Street has denied she misled the public or MPs. On its front page, The Guardian carries an interview with Rachel Reeves in which she defends her handling of the budget. She says that she made fair and necessary choices. The Times reveals that Prince Edward pays a peppercorn rent for the 120-room Surrey mansion he's leased from the Crown Estate. The paper forced the disclosure of documents, which it says shows the King's brother paid £5 million for a 150-year lease, but now spends a nominal amount to stay there. The Crown Estate and Buckingham Palace declined to comment. Billed as a world-exclusive investigation, the Daily Mail carries the story of a man who claims he is the real Mo Farah. The newspaper describes the complicated tale that led up to a sliding doors moment when the Olympian, Sir Mo Farah, whose real name is Hussein Abdi Kahin, was taken to Britain from war-torn Somalia when he was a young child on a visa meant for the real Mohammed Farah, who was left behind. And that's our look at the Sunday papers this morning. This Natural Life is in just a moment.
On BBC Radio 4...
It must be serious, that's the fraud squad.
I'm Shari Vahl and I've been investigating fraud for decades.
They want to create the impression of false trust.
Now I'm shining light on the secret techniques criminals use to steal your money.
This is what we call contextual vulnerability.
With insight from guest experts and the real people involved in these scams, so you can see the fraudsters coming before it's too late.
Stop. That is a massive red flag.
The new series of Scam Secrets. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4 on this Saturday morning, we'll join Martha Carney for a new series of This Natural Life.
It's approaching dusk here, deep in the Norfolk countryside, and we're waiting for the sky to grow black with tens of thousands of rooks and jackdaws returning to roost. There really is an uncanny gothic feel to this landscape, which may be exactly why it's the choice of my guest for This Natural Life, the writer Sarah Perry, known so well for her bestseller The Essex Serpent. And this is a special place for you.
It really is, yeah. It's somewhere where I come and I sort of almost feel my entire body and spirit kind of relaxing and thinking, yes, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Let's carry on up the road. Where are we heading to?
We're walking up a very gentle slope. We've got Buckenham Station behind us and we're heading towards an enormous home oak, which is an evergreen type of oak. And just underneath this little cluster of them, there's a Second World War pillbox. And by sort of silent consent, this is where people come and stand to watch the famous Corvid roost. So it's a very potent place for me.
So we're going to climb up over this bank to get to the best place.
Oh, get up to the top. What starts to happen is that all of the jackdaws and rooks and crows from the Broads, I think it's about 40 kilometres squared, just before dusk, all come down to this place and they slowly gather. And then there's a moment, it's like one of the birds has lifted its wing and given a signal, and they all lift up into the treetops. And the naturalist Mark Cocker used this amazing phrase and says the bare trees become foliated with rooks. It's really quite something. And it starts as a slow trickle, and then you can see them come from, because it's so flat, you can see them coming from all around until the signal is given, and then they all kind of go to bed.
It's an astonishing idea, isn't it, that they all know instinctively what to do at such an instant moment.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I think it sounds like a slightly trite thing to say, but this is where I derive so much of my sense of comfort when things seem so fractured and so uncertain. There's this constant community among the birds that they've been doing for centuries, probably thousands of years, all in communion with each other. And it makes me kind of see the long arc of time rather than this very brutal brief period that we feel like we're in at the moment.
And such, as you say, a communion, a sense of togetherness as well.
Yes, yeah, and a kind of magic as well. The moment when they all lift up, how do they know? It is like one of them's been appointed like the conductor of the band and lifts the wing up at a certain moment, and they'll go, right, bedtime lads, and up they go. It's amazing.
And just looking around us as we're waiting for this great spectacle to happen, this is such a special place because through the darkening leaves of the home oak, we can see across to the sunset and then the river in the distance. Is that the Yare?
I believe it is. It's beginning. Can you hear them?
I can hear them. Yeah. I can hear them. And look, there are a couple of black flapping birds,
yes,
on the horizon, just going over the edge
come.
Of that tree line.
Yes. And you get also, as well as the community of the corvids, the predators start to come out. So I saw a barn owl once just behind here, just coming behind the home oak.
We're hearing them.
There's this amazing moment of suspense where every single time I think it's not going to happen, it's not going to happen. And then you hear that initial call. And there's two very distinct ones. So a jackdaw to me sounds like it's saying why. It has like a why sound. And then you have the rooks and the crows that make much more of a kind of bark. It's lovely to hear it all start to happen.
I was actually looking up a passage in Mark Cocker's book, Crow Country, to read to you about the sounds of the birds. So he writes, the rook's voice is dark, earthy, coarse, tuneless, but in aggregate, it possesses a beautiful and softly contoured evenness. The jackdaws, meanwhile, produce sharp, chipped, lapidary notes like the sweet strike of flint on flint. And in this flinty landscape, nothing could be more appropriate.
Beautiful and right. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And oh, look, they're all start just to begin with. Each individual bird is so beautiful, and you watch them like, I think that might be a kestrel, actually. There's a kestrel just behind.
Oh, yes, hovering.
Yeah, look
the
at that.
The wind hover, as the Jerry wind Mandy hover, of Hopkins
which
would
say. I have a wind hover tattooed on my wrist because it's my favourite poem. So whenever... isn't it beautiful?
That's so... I'm seeing your tattoo,
yeah,
and the real wind look. Hover just behind. Oh, look.
And I love to recite the poem I saw this morning. Morning's minion, kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dapple drawn falcon in his riding of the rolling level underneath him, steady air. One of the reasons I love kestrels so much, my dad used to show them to me because they're a very... like East Anglian bird of prey, you know, we're not going to get a golden eagle in Chelmsford, but we saw kestrels and he taught me to recognise them. And they appealed to me because in the lore of falconry, a knave like me, you know, a lower class person would only be allowed to keep a kestrel. And if you kept anything more splendid than that, you'd be really in for it. So that's my bird and I'm very glad it showed up for us. I arranged that in advance.
Well, great to see the real bird and your tattoo. It sounds like an unusual childhood in the sense that it was very book orientated, no television. I think you said I grew up in 1895.
Yeah, that's the best way I can think of to describe it. And it was really ideal in some ways for somebody who was so solitary and loved literature so much. And I think if I'd been a child with a slightly different nature, there's the kestrel again. If my nature had been slightly different, I might have found it constraining, but actually for me it was very liberating because I could just let my imagination absolutely run riot with Tennyson and Conan Doyle and Dickens and all of the Agatha Christie novels. For your only recourse to be books and the piano and, you know, doing terrible watercolour copies of Pre-Raphaelite paintings was kind of ideal and really good training for a novelist. And although we weren't in the countryside, we had a relatively big garden for a sort of suburban house.
This is in Chelmsford?
In Chelmsford, yeah. And my parents laboured and laboured over their back garden, and we had pears and, you know, a greengage tree, and I was always being sent out with a Tupperware bowl to go and pick tomatoes for lunch. So I had like a really direct connection, even in, and that's one of the things that I really think that people should try to speak more about, us as being integral to nature and living in nature. Even if all you have is a garden, that is still the natural world. You don't need to drive out into the Lake District to participate in the natural world. We are creatures of nature.
Rather than going out into nature, we are part of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, we are. And I get slightly frustrated with this idea of nature as being like a mental health slot machine where, you know, you need 5 millilitres of nature 3 times a day. You know, that's, firstly, it doesn't exist to serve us. That's not what it's for. And also, we are in it. We are a constituent part of the natural world all of the time. And the natural world doesn't stop at the horizon. It, you know, it comprises the stars and the moon, and it's not as separate from us as people like to think. And I think that's politically really important, that it doesn't become a luxury for the classes who have the liberty of, you know, taking a boat out on Lake Windermere on a bank holiday. It's for everybody.
Yeah, you can look at butterflies growing on a buddleia coming out of a railway bridge.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Exactly that. Exactly that. And if you can... Is there a car coming? No, it's the birds. Can you hear it getting louder and louder? Can you hear the difference in register? Almost like a pipe organ. So it's exactly as Mark Cocker said, you've got that rumble of the rooks and crows and then the higher note of the jackdaws coming in over the top.
And that kestrel is still hovering over there.
Still there.
Part of our conversation. Now, Sarah, it was a very religious childhood, wasn't it? I think your parents were Baptists. And I wonder if that has given you a spiritual appreciation of the natural world.
I'm absolutely certain it has. There are so many phrases in scripture that speak, even to people who don't have a faith, of what the world that we live in can do to us. I think of it as being the quality of grace, which is the idea of undeserved favour, an undeserved gift, something beautiful that's given to everybody, whoever they are. And one of the things that I think is so amazing about that is that if you go out and you see a rainbow or a kestrel hovering over a hedge, it feels like a gift. We didn't do anything to earn it. I didn't pay for that kestrel to turn up. It's not because I've been really well behaved today. It's a gift. And you can either see that as being in some way divine or just part of us. That's a bird scarer we heard over there. So the farmers set off these cannons to keep the birds off their flock. So that's what that crack was. And can you just see through the branches that strip of sunset, just the last of the sun over there, that kind of coral band.
Bright orange, isn't it? Just above the line of the trees.
Yeah.
And that is the wonderful thing, isn't it, about East Anglia, are the skies and the way you can see so much of the sky all the time.
Yeah, I'm such a creature of the flatlands that I don't even like sort of Cheltenham and Bath because you can, well, you know, I remember once doing an event in Bath and I was walking down the street and there was a gap between the houses and the gap was completely filled with green because there was a hill behind them, and I found that so distressing. Where was the sky? Where was the sky? And what I like is this entire vault, this 180 degree vault. And paying attention, I think we forget that the natural world constitutes the sky too. And so if you can be as alert to the changing skies as you are to the changing leaves, and sometimes it looks like the inside of a mussel shell with that amazing kind of pearly grey blue. On an overcast day, if you tune your eye correctly, that's also beautiful. Or the clouds start to pile up like a kind of architectural structure. Or it looks like a flock of sheep grazing over. Oh, look, there's a whole... There they are. Look.
Oh, so many
of
them now.
They're starting to gather over that treetop. And sometimes they perform this choreography where they flirt with the treetops and then they all start to come down onto these fields and then they all fly back up again.
Yeah, some have just gone off the very tips
there
of the trees and gone down, down into the field.
And they say that it's the entire corvid population of the Norfolk Broads.
I was reading that there can be as many as 50,000 in this roost.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, here's the little local train coming through to Buckenham Station.
It's beautiful, isn't it? It's so romantic, and I love looking through the little square lighted windows and wondering where they're going and where they've been.
That's a writer's imagination.
Yeah.
I know exactly what you mean, just going back to what you were saying about the sky, because when my parents came to live in Suffolk, my mother said, oh, it's the big sky country. And at first I didn't know what she meant, and then I was making a programme in Somerset in the bottom of a valley, and I had that feeling of suffocation right deep down
there.
And you need to see this, and then you can breathe
That's
again.
That's exactly right. And I don't mind going to the Peak District or to Snowdon for a few days. That's lovely. I can, you know, I can tolerate a hill for a while, and they're all very beautiful, but this is mine. This is that Heimat word of belonging and of place.
Homeland.
And I think so much about the politics of the natural world, and how do we identify with and take pleasure in and derive satisfaction from our nationality and our environment in a way that is non-exclusionary, non-tub-thumping, non-nationalistic. And this is not political, this is not powerful in the sense of a power grab. This is just mine, and I'm not proud to be from here. That would be ridiculous. It's not an achievement, but I do feel that I belong here and that I'm in the right place.
You're obviously someone who loves nature so much. And when it comes to writing about landscape, do you kind of crystallise moments, do you think?
I try to. I think when you're writing, you have to kind of pick something that you can describe in enough detail that the part stands for the whole. And also when you're writing fiction in particular, there is no view from nowhere. So the way that you might view this scene if you had just fallen in love would be very different from how you viewed it if you'd just been bereaved. So as a writer, I could describe this tree and the gathering jackdaws in ways that evoke a number of different feelings, because we construct the world as we look at it, you know. It's not totally objective, it's subjective.
So I just saw some more birds flying along the tree line.
They form these kind of little individual flocks that then all amalgamate into this one community. And it's so unpredictable. I've been here at this... Oh, there's just a solitary one going up there. Sometimes by this time, that will be black. Sometimes there'll be nothing for ages, and then you turn round and they've gathered behind you to kind of trick you into it. And the whole time, the sound gathers and gathers and gathers until it gets really uproarious.
You were telling me about how, for a writer, the way you would describe a landscape is from a point of view, so it varies so much according to the character's experience.
Yeah, that's right. And I delight in that, really. I always try to treat place as a character in the book and to give it as much urgency and transformative power as an encounter with a person. And I think the world, if you pay attention, if you give it the attention it deserves, it enormously can affect your state of being, and that also works in reverse. And as a novelist, one of the things I tend to fight against is this idea that a novel should efface its artistry and just sort of slip down without friction like real life. I'm very comfortable with the fact that a novel isn't real, it's a work of art, and I will deploy the pathetic fallacy, and I will invent some weather in order to reflect a character's experience, and I will describe the natural world in a way that inflates the sensation of the novel, because it's not real, it's a work of art. And so I have this relationship to the natural world that is simultaneously I'm in it and I'm part of it, but also that I'm going to use it when I need to.
And you do love a simile, don't you? I'm thinking of one in particular, herons like white-coated orderlies.
Yes. There's our local pub. We live centrally in Norwich, which is about 20 minutes from here. And one of our local parks where we walk the dog has a resident heron, and he does pace up and down, and he looks like he's got his hands behind his back and he's kind of walking up and down. It's really great.
Yeah, that really gave me a very, very strong image of a heron when you wrote that. Now, look, Sarah, over there, there's a whole long line of birds above the tree line.
Can you hear that? If we walk along this ridge, along the roots of the oak, and come out from underneath the shade, it's really getting noisy now. And if we stand just where this longer grass meets the verge of the meadow, and then if we, sometimes when your ears are as good a tool as your eyes, hear that? Look. You see that long thread of them, look.
Yeah.
All in, look at that. That's extraordinary.
I'm just going to put my binoculars up. Oh, the sky is filling with them now. Black flappy. I've heard them described as like floating black handkerchiefs.
Oh, look, and look at that flock over there. Really thick cluster on top of that copse.
It
tends to make me think of iron filings being drawn towards a magnet.
As they go one way and the other,
yeah,
as the
absolutely.
Magnet moves around.
And look at this, almost like a roof of birds.
Coming so close to us now. I love that word, crepuscular.
Yes.
Really, we are living it now, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And that I also think that the world is kind of what you take it to be. So it would be so easy to say, oh, you know, this kind of drab grey sky. It's not drab. Look at the variations in the colour and then the way the birds thread across it. It's absolutely magical. And then the sunlight just kind of dwindling away there.
But you're right, all the different shades of grey. Well, there's the line of coral, as you say, from the sunset, and then lighter blue getting streaks darker and darker. It's funny, they're not the most popular of birds, are they, somehow, corvids?
They've
got a PR issue.
Which is extraordinary, because their intelligence is not that far off that of a primate. I think there's evidence of corvids having the capacity to use a tool to use another tool to get food. So it's sort of two stages away from just pecking at grubs. I always feel a bit sad when there's sort of one solitary one coming behind and he's a little bit late.
Because there is, in this case, I guess, literally safety in numbers.
There is, yes. And once or twice I've seen something, I think probably buzzards, interfere with the flock and it sort of scatters them. And you just think, oh, you opportunistic little so-and-so. Let them go to bed in peace. Look, there you go. Just over that thing there, very thick flock rising up out of that copse like smoke. And they just turned.
So many of them. Yes, you can see them floating just above the trees. I did want to ask you, Sarah, which is something we ask everybody who comes onto this natural life, is given what we hear about the crisis facing nature, climate change, is there anything that gives you cause for hope?
There is, and I think that people should perhaps talk more and think more on the successes recently. I can remember 20 years ago meeting someone who had a red kite nest outside her bedroom window, and I had never seen a red kite. And now, when my parents drive from the Midlands to visit us, they count red kites as they come. And I think they counted 36 last time. And I just caution against despair, because it is enervating. It prevents people from doing work because you think there's no point.
I completely agree with you. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, can you see over there? It's so thick, it's almost like it's part of the cloud cover.
That's the biggest flock we've seen yet, isn't it? It's huge.
Imagine how loud it would be if you were directly underneath it. And I think is it a line of poplars? But it is almost like they're kind of dissipating into the cloud. It's just extraordinary.
Because it's so dark now, isn't it?
Yeah,
the rain's starting and we're all melting.
Yeah, they're desperate to get to bed.
For today's edition of This Natural Life, I'm in Norfolk at Buckenham Cars, watching the great rook and jackdaw roost with the author Sarah Perry, whose latest books are Enlightenment and Death of an Ordinary Man. And Sarah, that was about the death of your father-in-law, David Perry. And did that whole experience, which you wrote about so movingly, did it make you more aware of the cycle of life and death?
It really did, in a way that I think's instructive and precious. And I say in the book that although it was a terribly traumatic and sad thing, he died 9 days after a cancer diagnosis, and my husband and I nursed him right to his death at home, and you can't go unaffected by that. But firstly, it was the biggest privilege of my life. And secondly, it gives you this sense of what a remarkable thing it is that we're here at all. And, you know, to see that last little flock go over as if they got the telegram late and they're trying to catch up. It's out of the whole incomprehensible scale of a finite universe. A number of particles form themselves into us now at this minute. And when it's over, it's never coming back. And it makes you determined to see the beauty and the grace and the marvellousness in a steely grey sky and a branch line train clattering out to Norwich. And I wouldn't ever forego having experienced that and having this sense that there aren't any ordinary lives and there are no ordinary birds and there's no ordinary landscape. It's all astonishing to me.
Sarah Perry, thank you so much for talking to us for This Natural Life.
Thank you.
This Natural Life was presented by Martha Carney and produced in Bristol by Beth O'Dea. What did farmers make of the budget? Farming Today this week is in a moment. First, let's hear about this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal.
Hello, Hugh Dennis here, with a few words about this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal with St Martin in the Fields charity. Across the UK, St Martin's helps people facing homelessness find a home. After years of being stuck in unsafe and overcrowded accommodation, a woman in Bristol told the charity she was able to move her family into a suitable house after receiving a grant for rent in advance. It's your generous support that makes this life-changing work possible. So before we launch this year's Christmas appeal, I want to say thank you.
This year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal with St Martin in the Fields is launched on Sunday, the 7th of December. Now on Radio 4, Farming Today this week with Charlotte Smith.
Good morning. This week, farmer protests about last year's budget as this year's was delivered.
I know a U-turn was probably exceptionally unlikely, but we were still hoping for some sort of change for this inheritance tax.
More on that later. First, though, dairy farming. According to the DEFRA Farm Business Income Survey for England, dairy farms were doing relatively well in the last financial year. Average incomes more than doubled year on year to around £153,000. Well, the reality at this moment may feel very different. The amounts farmers are paid for milk are falling in the wake of tumbling global dairy prices. The weather, too, has been a headache. Drought in some areas halted grass growth, which had a knock-on for winter fodder supplies, made a little easier by a fortuitously mild autumn. All this week on our sister programme, Farming Today, we looked at the dairy industry. Over the last 30 years, the size of the UK dairy herd has been gradually falling, while average milk yields, that's the number of litres a cow produces, have been steadily increasing. That increase is partly down to using new technology, like on-demand robotic milking machines. Stall Farms in Wiltshire uses robotic milking for their nearly 700-strong Holstein dairy herd, which lives indoors. Marie Lennon has been to meet farm manager Neil Ridgway and his rather quiet cows.
Very rare you'll hear a cow moo around here because they're so chilled out. The cows are chillaxed, sticking their heads out, being very inquisitive, demonstrating I don't want to say natural behaviours, obviously, because it is an indoor environment, but they can express their characters and their social aspects.
Tell me about the robotic systems.
Each cow has an identifying collar. The collar in itself has been collecting rumination data, pedometer data. Pretty much it's the Fitbit for cows. When that cow walks into the robot, it downloads all of that data back to the main PC. They'll only get milked when the system says it's within its thresholds of a perfect milking. We will go in so you can see it from the robot side.
Okay, in we go.
The cow on our left is just starting milking.
And these red robot arms are doing all the movement. They're using sensors to find exactly where they need to go.
So what the arm has just done after the last cow, it's sanitised around any part that's going to touch the next cow, so there's no cross-contamination. You might see the red laser flashing about. 12 robots are doing 2,000 milkings a day. The cow's happily stood there. She's eating what cake she's allowed out of the trough.
This must be one of the biggest dairy operations in the country.
Yeah, on one holding to itself, post the next shed, we will be 16 milking robots. As regards of yields, we've put 1,000 litres per cow per year for the last 4 years on, so we're now producing 12,500 litres a cow.
You've worked in a variety of different systems in different parts of the country and the world. Do you think that inherently in systems like this, the cows are missing out on an aspect of life that they should have, with having space to roam and the fact that there are so many of them together?
There is elements of that, and my last job was organic. I grew up on the Cheshire Dairy Flats, and I've done organic, I've done Channel Islands, I've done rare breed beef. Niche markets are all good and well when there's a market there. When it comes to people in the middle of Birmingham who rely on food as cheap as possible, when you have supermarkets, it's got to be done efficiently.
With milk itself, there are lots of pressures around the price, and lots of farmers are seeing their price per litre going down. You're producing here millions of litres.
9.2 million currently.
Right, so...
And the milk price dropped at Wee Face last week, although it was in low pence.
When you times it by 9.2 million?
It adds up, and a big part of it comes to business resilience.
Neil Ridgway there at Stoll Farms in Wiltshire. More on dairy farming on BBC Sounds. Just search for Farming Today. Despite a rise in the number of students taking up agriculture degrees over the last couple of years, not all courses are growing. The University of Nottingham is proposing to close its agriculture and business course at its Sutton Bonington campus. The university says applications for its farming courses have dropped, making them less financially viable. Well, in a moment, we'll hear from the university and from Sir Peter Kendall, the former National Farmers Union president who studied agriculture at Nottingham. First, though, Anna Hill spoke to Herbert Pickford, a fourth-year agriculture student at Nottingham, who started a petition to stop the course being suspended.
I mean, when we heard the news, kind of, we were all a bit shocked when we knew we needed to do something. We're over 3,800 signatures now, but from the responses I've got from the university so far, it doesn't really seem to be enough.
What have they said to you about the course, about why they're suspending it?
Primarily, it's the economics of it. Currently, universities all over the country are really struggling at the moment with their finances. So the fact that the agriculture courses aren't viable due to a low number of students has meant they're earmarking it as one of the first things to go.
How many people are on that course at the moment?
So across all 3 years, it's just over 50, I think 53. That's about 20 in third year and second year, but only 13 in first year.
It sounds like it would be actually quite expensive to run.
So it's quite hard to argue against that, but it's really frustrating because the university haven't really advertised it very well within the farming community. Its real USP is the fact that it's a real academic agriculture degree. The amount of research that goes on here, the lectures you're taught by, it's a very, very high-level academic course.
And what's the mood then amongst the students who are doing agriculture?
A lot of the first years, it's a lot of trepidation, really, because there's not going to be any students coming in underneath them. When they come to be in their final year, there will only be 13 people in their year. What will that be like? They're not going to have the same relationships with younger years within agriculture. They're not going to have the same vibrant agriculture society we have at the minute. And looking at their teaching experience, will the lecturers stay on?
Agriculture student Herbert Pickford. Sir Peter Kendall is a former NFU president and honorary professor at the University of Nottingham, where he studied agriculture. Anna asked him if closing agriculture courses there was the right thing to do.
And these courses bring everything together. Yes, you could look at some vet science or animal science somewhere, or a bit of husbandry or nutrition, but the challenges facing the world today of feeding what's forecast to be 10 billion or the 70 million plus in the UK is one of the biggest challenges facing mankind. This is when we need great scientists, great trained farmers and farm business managers. And to me, it's just a real tragedy if this actually goes through.
What happens then if this closes? How does that impact farming as a whole? Because we're not talking about a really large number of people here, are we?
There is a bit of a time at the moment where, because some of the mood around the industry is quite downbeat, that we send that message externally as well. But these are the courses that's training our farmers and practitioners for the future. So, yeah, you said if it's not a massive number of students, it's not going to be critical here and now, but we're losing critical capacity. And that's the thing that's a real shame. And look, I went to Nottingham back in the end of the 70s, early 80s, massively influential in my career. And I just want to make sure that before they make this decision, they know they've understood all the implications of it.
Sir Peter Kendall. Professor Zoe Wilson is Pro Vice Chancellor for the Faculty of Science at Nottingham University. She told me the courses just aren't viable and so have been suspended.
The decisions that we've made regarding course suspensions are really difficult ones to make. But basically, we feel that we've got no choice because the numbers of students on these programmes are incredibly small and they're not financially viable.
Well, students say that's partly because the course wasn't advertised widely enough, particularly within the farming community. And we are seeing, generally, more people interested in studying agriculture.
The challenge is that the numbers are really still quite small. We have done investigation into how many students are applying to do straight agriculture degree programmes, and actually it's not that that high at the sort of level that we would be looking. You know, it's quite an academically focused course in this area, so that again does constrain in terms of the tariff that is required for that programme. So we are still reviewing this. Council decision was to look into whether these courses should be closed, say they're suspended at the moment. There will be a full analysis of that. There's also the fact that closing courses is actually part of general university activity as business as usual. What we will be doing is looking to see whether there are other areas of development where a course that is more sustainable could be developed, because we're not wanting to stop our activity in agriculture. We recognise the real importance of this, both for, you know, food security, for the local community, as well as the national and the global one.
Well, this is the point that Sir Peter Kendall was making, that actually it is, in his view, important to study sort of straight agriculture. And there is a strategic importance, he says, of that, particularly given concerns about food security and climate change.
So we say fully recognise the importance of the discipline, but we aren't managing to recruit students to do this as a straight option, I think. And that's the difficulty, that the market isn't there. What we want to be able to do is to flex with some of the other courses that we run to offer the opportunities to get that experience of agriculture.
Professor Zoe Wilson. Cases of bird flu are still on the rise across the country, with outbreaks now in all four nations of the UK. And housing orders for England, Wales and Northern Ireland are in place, meaning all poultry has to be inside if the flock totals more than 50 birds. BBC Wales environment correspondent Stefan Messenger has been listening to the concerns of poultry farmers at the Royal Welsh Winter Fair in Bilth Wells.
Usually there'd be chickens running all over Alison Kennedy's farmyard and fields in the Llanfi Valley north of Bridgend. But here, as across Wales, they're having to be kept inside. It's to protect them from a highly infectious strain of avian flu.
We've had to put biosecurity measures in place as regards to the birds. We've had to keep them in. We've had to limit who can go in the sheds. It's a lot more harder, don't get me wrong, but if it's protecting the birds, it's what we got to do.
So the turkeys are in lockdown at the moment.
In Tremaine, Ceredigion, Kate Postens is rearing 500 turkeys ready for Christmas.
You know, it would break my heart to have to tell our customers, I'm really sorry, we don't have a turkey for you. It's just unfortunate that this is carried by wild birds. You know, seagulls were so close to the coast. You know, we've not been to the beach all summer because we knew it was there or potentially there. If we ever, or if any of our birds contracted it, I don't see a way back from us, because it would just be financially and emotionally, I think, too draining.
Since October the 1st, the start of a new bird flu season, there have been 50 cases recorded across the UK, including 7 in Wales. Industry leaders warn it could be one of the worst years yet for outbreaks of the disease, with devastating consequences for the affected farms.
I cannot overemphasise the concern out there.
David Jarrett is NFU Cymru's National Food and Farming Advisor.
More than anything, it's the random nature of the disease. You don't know where it'll turn up next. We'd like the results published earlier, and then if you get that information, that would be a huge benefit for other poultry producers.
Affected sites so far include a poultry unit with 31,000 turkeys near Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire, and another with 32,000 egg-laying hens near Cynwyd in Denbighshire. A site with 28,000 broiler chickens reared for meat was hit near Welshpool in Powys, while smaller farms and so-called backyard flocks have also been affected. Wales's chief vet says he and the Welsh Government are working closely with the industry, and farmers should do everything they can to protect their birds.
Richard Irvine, Chief Veterinary Officer for Wales. So, unfortunately, this year we've seen a number of cases of bird flu in Wales, but also in other parts of Great Britain. And we're seeing an uptick in those cases a little bit earlier than last year, and that naturally is a concern. The housing order has now come into force.
Longer term, is there a way out of this, or is it just something farms are going to have to get used to every year?
There are patterns that change year on year with regard to bird flu, but alongside that, one of the pieces of work that we're doing on a UK basis is the UK Vaccine Task Force for Avian Influenza. So that's ongoing work. That UK Vaccine Task Force published a report early this summer looking at the direction of travel with the possibility of vaccination being used for bird flu. So that's one option that may come to the fore in the future. The here and now, however, is that we are seeing an uptick in bird flu cases, and consequently for all poultry keepers, whatever your type of flock, whatever your size of flock, to do everything you can to protect your birds through the best possible hygiene and biosecurity measures.
That report from BBC Wales environment correspondent Stefan Messenger. Farmers were in London again this week, using this year's Budget Day to continue protests about the reimposition of inheritance tax on farming and business assets of more than £1 million, something announced in last year's budget. Many of them had been planning to take part in a tractor protest, but less than 24 hours before it was due to start, the Metropolitan Police told the organisers that no agricultural vehicles could be brought to the event. That caused both anger and confusion, and hundreds of tractors did arrive in London. One of the protest organisers, farmer Colin Rayner, told me the police's decision was a total surprise and wrong.
We had it all planned, all organised, agreed with the Metropolitan Police. The committee had a meeting with the police on Zoom at 3 p.m. yesterday afternoon and cancelled it and said we couldn't park in Whitehall, and if we parked in Whitehall we'd be arrested and carted off to jail.
To be fair, the Met Police will point out they didn't stop the protest. They just said please don't bring tractors because of the impact it has on emergency services and Londoners going about their day.
I have to beg to differ, because they have protests in London every weekend by
but
various...
Not with tractors.
But we came here last time and the Metropolitan Police said there was the best protest that they've ever seen, best well behaved, and the farmers even cleaned up after themselves. And what we've got today is chaos.
Well, there are lots of tractors around Trafalgar Square. I've just walked down. We've got reports of some people being arrested because they won't move their tractors. But it was clear that tractors couldn't be brought this time.
It's quite clear that you couldn't park in Whitehall. And our original plan was to drive up here, do a circuit of Westminster and go home. But when we got here, the police parked us up on Trafalgar Square and told us to go and walk to the Mall for the protests.
Why were you protesting in the first place? Because we had Angela Eagle on Farming Today last week and she said she understands people's anger, but we are where we are, time to move on.
Our family have farmed for a very long time. We can't lose it.
But you won't. You have plenty of time, 7 years you've got, to gift that to your offspring.
Unfortunately, if you make that 7 years, and I've dealt with my parents' deaths and the tax we had to pay then, and that was crippling. And when my grandparents died in the 60s, my parents were poor for 20 years, paying the death duties and selling houses and selling property. And we went without in the 60s and 70s. I don't want my children to suffer that.
But they won't. If you get yourself organised, you've got 7 years to gift bits away to get under the threshold, so you won't be affected by this at all.
That's on the thing that I can live 7 years and whether my children want to take it on. It's not only the inheritance tax, it's every other tax. They don't want us to farm. And for some reason, we're not liked by this government.
The government would deny that, obviously, and they will say this is a fair tax. And a lot of people in today's budget will no doubt be affected by paying more tax in one way or another. Why should a farmer be any different?
We wouldn't object so much if the tax was spent wisely. When we see billions of pounds going overseas...
But that's a completely different argument, isn't it, about how tax is spent?
No.
You are, by any stretch of anyone's imagination, sitting on millions of pounds worth of land, in many cases, on farms. So why shouldn't you pay tax?
Well, it would mean the split up of our farm, unfortunately. And then it would become uneconomic. And the tax burden for the next generation would be too great. If you see who is protesting today, it's mainly under 30-year-old boys and girls who are up here worried about their future. And we've looked after the country, all of us, for hundreds of years and done a really good job. And I just think the government needs to rethink and give us time. You know, and there's other ways. You know, the NFU have come up with the other ways they can tax us, which are fair. I don't think it's fair.
Colin Rayner. The Metropolitan Police refused our request for an interview, but in a statement said, "This decision was taken due to the serious disruption they, tractors, may cause to the local area, including businesses, emergency services and Londoners going about their day." They said that those in tractors were advised to leave and that the majority listened to officers and complied, but that several arrests were made. Well, protesting farmers on foot were guided to an area opposite the gates to Downing Street, where a few hundred gathered and listened to the Chancellor. There was just one mention of inheritance tax in Rachel Reeves' speech.
I reformed inheritance tax on agricultural and business assets. And this year, I am aligning those reforms with wider inheritance tax rules by allowing the transfer of the 100% relief allowance between spouses, balancing the taxation of these valuable assets with the realities of family life.
That didn't impress those listening farmers or the Leader of the Opposition, Kemi Badenoch.
She should be on the side of people who get up and go to work, people who take a risk to start a company, people working all hours to keep their business afloat. She should be on the side of the farmer trying to hand something over to the next generation.
Outside the gates to Downing Street, protesting farmers had hoped for a lot more from the Chancellor.
That's a small back down, really, but it's still nowhere near enough, not for the amount of money. With the seasons and the way the harvests are at the moment and our returns, there's just no way we can run to it. So it's tinkering. She needs to up the limit if she's going to do anything.
Given the huge discrepancy between the capital value of property and its productive value, whether it's you or you and your spouse or you and anybody else, you can't pay it.
Have you been following the budget as you stand here outside Downing Street?
I know a U-turn was probably exceptionally unlikely, but we were still hoping for some sort of change on at least ring fencing that older generation that haven't had time to plan for this inheritance tax. The government not bending any of the policy at all is disgusting.
Well, the president of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw, told me the budget was disappointing.
Obviously, there's been a small amendment within today's budget on the inheritance tax proposals, which means that the spousal allowance can be transferred. And that is backdated to enable those that have already lost a spouse to make use of that spousal allowance. So they will be eligible for up to £2 million once you bring in that allowance. But it's a really, really small change, Charlotte. It does not remove the human pressure, which is so intolerable for that older element of our community and those that are terminally ill. It's still an evil policy which has them trapped with no way to plan. And we will continue to fight the policy.
Well, surely what this does in practice is raise the threshold for people who have a spouse because it allows you to transfer that allowance.
No, because if your spouse was alive, then you already had between you both had the £1 million allowance. So what it's meant is that in the tragic circumstances of an early death where your children may not be old enough to inherit, you don't have to pass that down to the next generation at an inappropriate stage. So it makes it far more possible to plan when it is right to pass that down. There was an element here for those that already lost a spouse where they weren't going to have access to that £1 million that their spouse would have had. It now means that they will be able to access that. So it's a change which is welcome. It's also recognition that the policy isn't correct, which again we've been pushing for over a year now.
The government has argued consistently since last year's budget that this is a fair tax and that it will go ahead. Is it time to accept that and move on, as the Farming Minister Angela Eagle put it on this programme last week?
We cannot move on, Charlotte, while there is that sector of our community that don't have any ability to plan because they don't expect to live for very long beyond April next year. While they are still trapped within this policy, we are absolutely focused now on how we can amend the finance bill to try and mitigate the impact on those that are trapped within this pernicious tax. And that is what we'll be doing over the next few weeks.
I just want to move on to some of the other things that were mentioned. Increase in the national minimum wage and indeed the living wage, free apprenticeships for the under 25s. Both of those will have an effect, won't they, on some farming businesses?
The free apprenticeships one is actually good news. The agricultural industry should be very well placed to provide apprenticeships and to draw people in that maybe want to leave school at an earlier age. So that is something that we will welcome. On the national living wage, that is another inflationary pressure within our food system. And the moment the government are desperate to try and mitigate food price inflation, well, that national living wage increasing 4.1% will drive inflation through the whole system. And that will end up coming through to the retail shelf because our members cannot absorb those cost increases. It must go up the supply chain.
President of the National Farmers Union, Tom Bradshaw. And that's it from us. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer is Beatrice Fenton. And Farming Today This Week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
The Today programme isn't too far off. First, the weather forecast, and we're joined by Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you very much. Well, today there's a Met Office yellow weather warning in force for heavy rain, and that's for many parts of England and Wales, excluding the far northwest and the far southeast. 20 to 30 millimetres of rain falling quite widely, locally as much as 50 millimetres, and over higher ground there could be as much as 60 to 80 millimetres. And of course, all of that rain could lead to some localised flooding as a developing area of low pressure that's eventually going to spin off into the North Sea. So already a wet start to the day across parts of Wales, southwest England into northern England too. That rain is slowly going to drift eastwards towards East Anglia, Yorkshire, Humberside into the afternoon, and then it will clear away into the North Sea. And the winds are going to be picking up a brisk northwesterly as we head through the latter part of the day towards eastern coastal areas. And some of the rain could produce perhaps a little bit of snow over the Pennines, the Welsh Mountains. For Scotland, there will be some showers around and some light patchy rain towards the far south and the east, and some of the showers over the higher ground could fall wintry in places. But here there's going to be plenty of dry and bright weather. It's not a bad looking day, certainly a much nicer looking day for northwestern Scotland than it was yesterday. Northern Ireland too largely dry, a few showers towards eastern areas, cloudy start brightening up later on. It's quite cold in the north today, 3 to 8 degrees Celsius, but it's milder further south. In fact, some temperatures could get as high as double figures perhaps. And then tonight, well, that area of low pressure clears away into the North Sea. Still very windy for North Sea facing coast, and there'll still be some showers here, maybe one or two wintry showers for Scotland as well, but a ridge of high pressure builds in, so lots of dry weather, clear skies. Temperatures are likely to drop below freezing for many as well, so it's a chilly, frosty start to the day tomorrow. Tomorrow a much nicer looking day for most of us. Still brisk winds for eastern facing coast, but there'll be a lot of brightness and sunshine, and it's largely dry but colder.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Across this week, Radio 4 chronicles a frantic legal case.
I got a phone call from Scotland Yard asking if I was free that evening.
The unexpected story of how a former dictator was brought to justice.
I said, what's going on? He said, well, we're going to go and arrest General Pinochet.
I'm Philippe Sands, and I'll be hearing how a few tenacious lawyers fought to apprehend a man suspected of orchestrating the deaths of thousands of people.
I just simplistically thought that he was no longer head of state and therefore he wouldn't have immunity.
Suddenly, overnight, the strategy of the prosecuting office changes.
The Arrest on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. This Monday to Friday at 1:45.
This is BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM on BBC Sounds and your smart speaker.
Good morning. It is 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 29th of November. Hope you're doing okay at the start of the weekend. This is Today with Simon Jack and Emma Barnett.
The headlines this morning: asylum seekers are to be banned from using taxis to get to medical appointments after journeys of hundreds of miles were revealed by a BBC investigation. We'll discuss at 8:10. And airlines around the world are working to install a software update on thousands of planes after Airbus said solar radiation could cause some flight controls to malfunction.
Also coming up in today's programme, we'll hear from the man who spoke to President Zelensky's outgoing right-hand man just before he resigned.
He, in the call with me yesterday, made very clear one thing, that Ukraine will not trade away its territory in these negotiations.
And inside the UK's first major sculpture exhibition, curated by blind and partially blind artists.
It almost feels like a maze, but it's on a kind of bouncy pivot. And it's got, it does that when you move it. Ooh, hey, oh. Okay, it's noisy.
And I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport, as we'll be hearing from England cricket captain Ben Stokes on describing his team not as arrogant and getting the latest from Qatar as McLaren's Lando Norris could clinch the Formula One Drivers' Championship with a weekend to spare.
And now the BBC News, read by Tom Sanders.
The government is to ban the use of taxis funded by the taxpayer to take asylum seekers to medical appointments after ministers launched an urgent review in response to a BBC investigation earlier this year. Radio 4's File on 4 investigates found examples of the practice costing hundreds of pounds, including a 250-mile journey to see a GP. Here's our political correspondent Nick Eardley.
The BBC revealed earlier this year that taxis were being used for journeys such as to doctor's appointments, sometimes hundreds of miles away at an expense of hundreds of pounds. The Home Office announced a review in response, and now the use of taxis is to be banned from February for medical travel. There will be limited exemptions, including for people with physical disabilities and pregnancy-related needs, but these will have to be approved by the Home Office. The Home Secretary said that would only happen in the most exceptional circumstances and that she would continue to root out waste. There are other examples where taxis are sometimes used, such as when people are moved between accommodation. The Home Office is continuing to review that situation, but wants to expand the principle that taxis are only used in extraordinary circumstances. It's also been revealed today that the average annual cost of all forms of transport for asylum seekers is £15.8 million.
Airlines are making urgent modifications to thousands of Airbus planes after the firm discovered intense solar radiation could interfere with onboard flight control computers. The issue affects the A320 family of aircraft, one of the most widely used models in the world. Passengers have been warned of possible disruption, although many airlines said that they had already resolved the issue. Nick Johnson reports.
Last month, a JetBlue flight from Cancun in Mexico to Newark in the United States experienced a sudden drop in altitude. Airbus said radiation from the sun was found to interfere with sensors critical to the aircraft's flight controls. Action is now being taken to prevent a similar incident, with more than 6,000 Airbus planes thought to be vulnerable to the same problem. For many affected aircraft, the issue can be resolved with a straightforward software update. EasyJet says it's already completed the fix and expects to operate normally today. Heathrow and Manchester Airport say they do not expect widespread disruption, while Gatwick says some delays are possible. In a statement, the Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander said the impact on UK airlines appeared to be limited. She's urged passengers due to fly this weekend to check with their airline for the latest information.
3 days of official mourning have begun in Hong Kong after a devastating fire ripped through several tower blocks on Wednesday. Government officials stood outside the headquarters to observe a 3-minute silence in memory of the 128 people known to have died. From Hong Kong, Danny Vincent reports.
Flags at all government offices are flying at half-mast as people across Hong Kong mourn those killed in the world's worst residential building fire in decades. A number of condolence books have been set up throughout the city for people to sign. King Charles has sent a message of support, saying he and the Queen were greatly saddened by what he called an appalling tragedy. Officials are working at the scene of the fire to confirm the identities of victims and collect evidence for an investigation into how it began. The number of victims is expected to rise, as around 200 people remain unaccounted for. The authorities have arrested 11 people in connection with the blaze, with investigators focusing on possible corruption and the unsafe use of building materials.
The Trump administration says it's halting all asylum decisions in the wake of the shooting in Washington of 2 members of the National Guard, one of whom has died. Wednesday's attack has been blamed on an Afghan national. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Writing on social media, the head of the US Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency, Joseph Edlow, said all asylum decisions had been halted until officials could be sure that every alien would be vetted to the maximum degree possible. A short time later, the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed that no new visas would be issued to people travelling on an Afghan passport. Both announcements come the day after the death of a National Guard soldier, Sarah Beckstrom. The 20-year-old was one of 2 guards shot near the White House on Wednesday. The suspected killer is an Afghan national who entered the US in 2021 as part of a program recognizing his service alongside US forces in Afghanistan. He was granted asylum earlier this year. President Trump says Joe Biden's administration failed to thoroughly vet immigrants to the US.
The authorities in Ukraine say a nighttime Russian drone attack on the capital Kyiv has killed 2 people and injured several others. Loud explosions were heard across the city as several apartment blocks were hit. Reports suggest Ukrainian negotiators will visit the United States this weekend for talks with American officials on President Trump's plan to end the war with Russia. President Putin has said a US team are due to hold discussions in Moscow next week. The author of an independent review of the carer's allowance benefit has told Radio 4's Moneybox the government must set about implementing her recommendations at pace. Liz Sace found that confusing guidance on carer's allowance, which is given to those providing at least 35 hours of unpaid care a week, has left thousands of people with fines and surprise bills. Dan Whitworth reports.
Carers UK has welcomed this report as a landmark moment for people who care for loved ones, often with severe physical or learning disabilities. Key recommendations include reassessing nearly 200,000 cases where carers have been pushed into debt, committing to simplifying a complicated claim system, and acknowledging how carers have been let down by confusing rules for many years. By no means will every carer in debt have that cancelled or reduced, but by accepting what campaigners have argued for so long, that the system fundamentally let carers down, the government has taken huge steps towards putting things right. The government said carers deserved a benefit that reflected their vital contribution to society, and that it was determined to fix problems with carers' allowance it inherited.
The Pope is visiting Istanbul's Blue Mosque as part of his trip to Turkey and Lebanon. He'll also preside over his first public mass as Pope outside Italy. Our religion editor Ali Makbul is travelling with the Pontiff.
His visit to the Blue Mosque will be Leo XIV's first to a Muslim place of worship as Pope. It fits the theme of this trip so far of building bridges and unity. He'll later sign a joint declaration with Patriarch Bartholomew, who's spiritual leader to the world's Eastern Orthodox Christians, in a symbolic move, though what it'll mean in practice isn't yet known. The pair have already prayed together here with other Christian leaders who've flown in, though the absence of representation from the Russian Orthodox Church has been notable and perhaps shows the limits to calls for togetherness. Pope Leo will end the day by leading Mass in an arena in Istanbul on the final evening of the Turkey part of this trip.
Everton Football Club will today unveil a bench dedicated to their former captain Gary Speed, who took his own life 14 years ago at the age of 42. The so-called talking bench has been installed at the Hill Dickinson Stadium at the request of the Everton Fans Forum. The club says it's designed to encourage conversation, tackle loneliness and isolation, and highlight where people can get further support for their mental health.
Thanks, Tom. 9 minutes past seven. Let's have a quick look through the papers this morning. And if the Chancellor wanted to put her feet up after a gruelling budget week, she won't like the look of some of the headlines. Chancellor of the Exchequer, it says in The Sun. Liar Reeves must go now, says the Daily Mail. Reeves on brink over tax lies is the headline in the Daily Telegraph. And this all based on this spat, if you like, between the OBR and the Treasury. The Office of Budget Responsibility, the forecaster, told Rachel Reeves there was no big black hole in the budget long before she started making those overtures about possibly having to raise income tax. And that basically the argument is, did she mislead, and to what end did she mislead businesses, the markets, taxpayers, etc.? And she says, the quote in the Telegraph, we did look, as everyone knows, at income tax and national insurance. That was a responsible thing to do, given the size of the downgrade. Big argument about who knew what when.
Indeed, which I'm sure we'll come back to. There's in the Times on page three, one of the main stories there. Prince Edward pays peppercorn rent for a 120-roomed Surrey mansion. The King's brother enjoys that mansion at a peppercorn rent that the Times has been able to find out, forcing the disclosure of documents held by the Crown Estate. So campaigners wondering how Bagshot Park, where he lives, how that lease can be justified. On the inside the Mail, there's a very powerful interview with Trudy Burgess, who earlier this year was in intensive care for the most extraordinary survival of violence by her former partner. She was paralysed by from the chest down. It's got the details of that, but it really also illuminates how strong control and coercive control can be in relationships. As she said, even after he snapped my neck and left me paralysed, I still tried to protect Robert, talking about her partner. And just looking to some of the other stories making several of the papers, one story in particular, which we'll be coming back to, is the lead on the front page of the Telegraph, one of the front page stories. Rishi Sunak is leading calls for the health secretary to overrule recommendations that deny prostate cancer screening to most men. That draft advice from the UK National Screening Committee rejected calls to offer tests more widely. We will have someone from the National Screening Committee, and Rishi Sunak joining calls with the likes of the Olympian Sir Chris Hoy and Lord Cameron, or David Cameron, who had been diagnosed recently with the disease. So we'll come back to that story.
It is 12 minutes past seven. The world's most popular short-haul aircraft has a problem, which means the world's airlines have a problem. Around 6,000
Airbus A320 planes are thought to be affected by a fault with its onboard computer. Nick Johnson's our correspondent, joins me here. What's the problem, Nick? How serious?
Well, Airbus has found that intense radiation from the sun can actually interfere with its onboard computer systems, those computer systems which process the plane's flight control, specifically the pitch of its nose and the nose angle. In terms of how serious, well, actually, the fix for this is fairly straightforward. It involves a software update, a bit like when we plug our phones in overnight for the latest software. But for some older aircraft, it could involve a plane being in a hangar and a computer system being taken out and replaced. I think the issue is because there are so many of these A320s, they're like the workhorse of the sky. You've got to take them all out of service at one time. And that obviously provides logistical challenges. So in terms of disruption, minimal, luckily, for UK-based airlines at the moment. Actually, EasyJet overnight, which has a lot of these A320s, says that they've actually performed the software update already and they're hoping to run a normal service this morning. Wizz Air also has a number of these Airbus aircraft. It says to expect some disruption today. Our three main airports, Heathrow, Gatwick and Manchester, all say they're not expecting widespread disruption. But as always, the advice is to passengers, do check with your airline before travelling.
OK, Nick, thanks very much indeed. Nick Johnson there. Let's talk to John Strickland, Director of JLS Consulting and Air Transport Consultancy. And John, it is amazing given how many planes there is. I mean, how did this first emerge as a problem?
It emerged because there was a single incident with a JetBlue flight flying from Mexico to New York about 2 weeks ago, and that's where we had this uncommanded descent or pitch down on the aircraft, and the pilots had to make a recovery from that. And that was caused by solar flare activity. And we've seen the outcome of that coming with this airworthiness directive in the last 24 hours.
And as I say, this is something on the world's most popular short-haul aircraft. It seems quite interesting that it hasn't emerged before.
Nature of what happened. I certainly hadn't heard of anything like this before having such a serious effect on an aircraft. I've heard of solar flare activity sometimes interfering with radio transmissions, but nothing that affects safety of flight and control of the aircraft.
Mm-hmm. And these days, there is no mechanical connection between instruments and the actual engine and all the other stuff. It is all by computer. So it is by its nature vulnerable to these kind of, I suppose, electromagnetic interruptions.
I mean, certainly the Airbus system is fly-by-wire, as you said, with far less reliance on mechanical connections. The positive side of that, I mean, we've seen this aircraft, the Airbus family, in service for near on 40 years now. Of course, the aircraft flying today in the world fleets are much newer, physically produced models, and it has got an exemplary safety record. And the fact that it can be rectified, certainly on about 75-80% of the fleet so quickly with a software update, again, gives me confidence that we should still keep confident in this aircraft type.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's right, you say there's something, when something like this happens and the industry adjusts quite quickly, in a way, it's not a cause for alarm, it's a cause for reassurance. And the aviation industry has always struck me as being quite good at sharing info. When something bad happens, they get together and share as much information and things get dealt with quickly.
It has to be absolutely that way. I mean, safety is the pivotal, preeminent focus of the industry. And as you said, the aim is to share information quickly, move quickly. And the fact that we only heard about this late yesterday afternoon, and we've seen action taken by airlines all over the world incredibly quickly, using the available manpower, using the software updates and aircraft that were planned to be on the ground to work quickly. But, we're getting some differences in actual delay and cancellation according to airline. And again, that reflects a focus on safety. A flight's never going to be operated. It will always be delayed or cancelled if that's what it takes to maintain safety. Of course, we saw that after the two tragic Boeing crashes where we got a grounding of the entire fleet of 737 MAXs running into years.
Yeah. Okay, John, thank you for that. John Strickland, Director of JLS Consulting. And before that, Nick Johnson. And the advice, by the way, from the Department of Transport is to check with your airline before heading to the airport.
It's 16 minutes past seven. After an urgent review prompted by a BBC Radio 4 documentary, that was one of our File on 4 investigates, called Inside the Migrant Hotel, the government is now banning asylum seekers from using taxis to attend most medical appointments. The Home Office has also confirmed it spent nearly £16 million a year on transport for asylum seekers in recent years.
The ban on cabs will be from February, excuse me, and only for almost all medical appointments. Harry Farley, our political correspondent, is here. Harry, remind us of how this came about, and you know, for people who didn't know, this was a norm. It had become one, hadn't it?
It had, yes. This all came about because of a BBC Farland 4 investigation into the conditions in asylum hotels and to some of the practices that went on there. And as you say, one of the things that really grabbed attention is the use of taxis. To explain why that is, asylum seekers get issued with one bus pass a week, and any other what's called necessary travel is a taxi is booked. And that resulted, we found at the BBC, in some quite extraordinary things. You know, one asylum seeker said they went on a 250 mile round trip for a GP visit, and only this week a subcontractor has told the BBC that his firm would do up to 15 drop-offs from a hotel in southeast London to a doctor's surgery around 2 miles away, costing the Home Office around £1,000 a day. So what's happening now is the Home Office has done this review. They say for medical appointments, the use of taxis will end, apart from in exceptional circumstances. There are some other cases when taxis are used, for example, when asylum seekers are being transferred between accommodation. The Home Office is still looking into that, but the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, said that she wants that principle of only taxis only being used in the most exceptional circumstances to continue.
What was it for, security in some way? Do we not know? Was it to know where people were, to have some sort of hold?
It's a really good question. I don't think we fully got to the bottom of why that was. As I say, they're giving one bus pass for one return journey per week, and anything beyond that, taxis were used for. I suppose more broadly, the government has said they want to end the use of asylum hotels altogether before the next election, and ideally beforehand. They want to move asylum seekers into other sites like military barracks, for example. We got a little insight this week into just how difficult that will be, because actually the latest figures this week show that more than 36,000 people are still living in asylum hotels. That's gone up.
That's actually gone up, hasn't it?
It's gone up since last June. And then last night, the initial plans to move some asylum seekers into two military bases near Crowborough and near Inverness, they've actually been delayed.
There you go. Interesting. Harry Farley, our political correspondent. Thank you. We'll come back to this story with the reporter behind that documentary, and also to hear what's been the response from wider political parties and the Home Select Committee too.
It's 19 minutes, nearly 20 past seven.
There have been 57 cases of bird flu so far this season on farms across the UK. Tens of thousands of turkeys and chickens have recently been culled following a spate of cases in Mid, West and North Wales. And now we've learned that there are preparations underway for a controlled bird flu vaccine trial in turkeys. Christine Middlemiss, our Chief Veterinary Officer, good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
Can you tell us a bit more about this trial, how it will work, how it came about?
So we had, obviously, as we know, we've had a spate of bird flu cases for the last 5 years with massive impact for industry. And we've worked hard with industry to understand the positives and negatives of vaccination. They undertook, they sent out a report this summer from a joint task force, and it recommended trialling vaccine in turkeys. So we're looking at taking that forward.
Why turkeys?
Because the time, well, for various reasons, the time of year that we tend to get bird flu is during our seasonal turkey production. They also looked at the cost benefit of vaccination, and turkeys for us as an important sector, we think there could be benefit. So we need to understand now just how effective a vaccine in turkeys might be.
And is this something that has, you know, been long called for? I'm just thinking what you've said about how long this has been going on, and you know how devastating this has been, not just in the UK but around the world. And yet we also know that in France they've been vaccinating meat ducks since 2023. China and Vietnam are also vaccinating, and trials in Germany and Italy too. Are we behind on this?
No, we're working very closely with many partners internationally. France, as you say, have been vaccinating for a couple of years. What we've seen is that it totally dampens down the virus, but it does not stop it. So they've had six cases very recently in those ducks. So that's exactly what we need to understand. How effective will the vaccine last, and how long will it last? And that's why we want to do the trial.
Is there any potential harm, you know, either to birds or to humans because of vaccine? What are the concerns apart from how efficient it will be?
So the concerns are it dampens down the infection, but then you don't see it and you still have virus that is spreading.
Right.
And our absolute number one priority is to stop any virus spreading to other birds, to mammals, potentially to people.
Oh, okay. So how big is that risk?
Our human health colleagues tell us the risk is very low, but in very specific circumstances, lots of ongoing contact with infected birds, there can be risk, and that's why their advice is don't handle sick or dead birds.
And when will this happen by, do we know?
No, we don't have a date
we
yet.
We don't have a date.
We're working up the trial actively. There are a number of moving parts with it, and we're looking urgently to put those in place.
Okay, urgently so. Christine Middlemiss, our Chief Veterinary Officer, thank you.
The COVID inquiry rumbles on. A couple of weeks ago, we had the government response bit, and it has now started its penultimate module. This is the bit where they look at the economic impact of the pandemic. Last week, the outline of the module began to take shape with evidence from some of those in office at the time. Theo Leggett reports.
Tens of thousands of lives could have been saved at the start of the coronavirus pandemic if the UK government had acted faster.
The failure to respond effectively cost 23,000 lives in England in the first wave.
Last week, the long-running COVID inquiry exploded back into the public consciousness. Its latest report excoriated the tardy initial response to the pandemic, which it blamed on a lack of leadership from Downing Street. The inquiry's chair is Baroness Hallett.
Nonetheless, I can summarise my findings of the response as too little, too late. All four governments failed to appreciate the scale of the threat or the urgency of response it demanded in the early part of 2020.
This week, as the dust settled and the smell of bureaucratic cordite faded, the inquiry got back to work. It's now looking specifically at the economic steps taken following the outbreak. And it started by hearing personal stories of how people were affected when normal life was suspended and businesses had to pull up the shutters.
No money, no work, nothing. Just looking into an empty void. No savings, no backup, no nothing. And a mortgage and a child at home.
One of the guys that I've made redundant, I've known him 40 years. And to sit there and say, sorry, you've got to go. It was just dark, really dark.
So people started selling their wedding rings. You have parents that, parents who skip meals so they could feed their children. Absolutely.
It was in late March 2020 that the most severe restrictions on socialising and businesses started to take effect. The inquiry's lead lawyer, Richard Wright KC, reminded those present just how serious the economic impact had been.
Data from the most recent quarter, in which just 16 days had been affected by social distancing measures, recorded a fall in GDP at the sharpest rate since the general strike of 1926, and the Office for Budget Responsibility was predicting the largest fall in United Kingdom economic output for over 300 years.
If the crisis was unprecedented, so too was the response, and it was set out by the then Chancellor Rishi Sunak on the 20th of March.
Today I can announce that for the first time in our history, the government is going to step in and help to pay people's wages. We're setting up a new coronavirus job retention scheme. Any employer in the country, small or large, charitable or non-profit, will be eligible for the scheme.
The job retention scheme, better known as furlough, was a centrepiece of the government's response. There was another scheme for people who are self-employed but unable to work. And at the inquiry, witnesses said they did think these measures had been effective. Here's Sam Jacobs, representing the TUC.
They avoided mass redundancies, limited damage to and loss of self-employed businesses, and reduced the severity of long-term economic scarring. By July 2021, 11.6 million people and 1.3 million employers had used the CJRS.
But other parts of the economic response were criticised.
I swear by almighty God that the evidence I shall give...
The former Work and Pensions Secretary, Therese Coffey, was asked why a £20 a week boost to universal credit and working tax credit wasn't also offered to those still on older so-called legacy benefits, like the Job Seekers Allowance.
It was to particularly help those people who were facing the most disparate adjustment to their incomes as a result of the pandemic. So those suffering could be suffering an economic shock, principally people who were probably going into benefits for the first time.
Baroness Coffey was also asked why disabled people who weren't on Universal Credit were unable to join the Kickstart programme, a scheme designed to get unemployed young people back into work. She insisted there'd been no discrimination.
Bear in mind, we'd been set a challenge in the 2017 manifesto of getting 1 million more people with disability into work within a decade, and we did it in 5 years. The idea of aspects of disability was just in our DNA.
Over the next few weeks, the inquiry will be hearing a lot more about the economic response to the pandemic, including the actions of the Bank of England, steps taken independently of government, but no less critical. The hearings resume next week.
And you can hear more from Theo, and in fact the entire inquiry so far, in the form of the COVID Inquiry podcast, which you can find on BBC Sounds.
It's 28 minutes past seven. Sarah Orchard's back here with the sport. Hello again.
A very good morning to you. Well, where else can we start but Brisbane, ahead of that second Ashes test, where the England captain Ben Stokes has come out to defend the character of his team.
You can call us rubbish, call us whatever you want to be, and we didn't have the test match that we wanted to. We were great in passages of that game. Arrogant might be a little bit too far, but that's okay. We'll take the rough with the smooth, but I'd rather the words like rubbish, but arrogant, sometimes you're a bit like, oh.
Well, his comments come after the first test ended in that heavy defeat to Australia in just 2 days. You can hear more of that interview on the Test Match special podcast on BBC Sounds. And we'll hear from the TMS team in Brisbane after 8:25 this morning. We know that Mark Wood was the only member of the squad to miss training earlier. Meanwhile, in Canberra, the Prime Minister's 11 won the toss and opted to bat against the England Lions. There's commentary of that on Sports Extra right now and BBC Sounds. A few moments ago, the Prime Minister's 11 were 161. For two. Now, it's a huge weekend ahead for Britain's Lando Norris, who could secure a maiden F1 world title. Now, he can't do it today in the Qatar sprint race and says he's not expecting to beat title rival and teammate Oscar Piastri anyway. Norris qualified third. Piastri is on pole with Max Verstappen sixth. Now, Norris will become champion on Sunday if he can score two more points than both his rivals over the course of the weekend. Let's speak to BBC Sports F1 reporter Jenny Gow, who's in Qatar for us. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
There you are. Good morning. Now, do you think the pressure of the weekend has got to Norris in that sprint qualifying yesterday?
It was a messy lap that he went out there and completed, but a lot of people had the same issue. It's a very aggressive, fast, bumpy, curby track here. But he said he feels relaxed, and he said, actually, speaking afterwards, that's his strength for now.
Oh, I think
he starts in third place, but he just has to find a way round his rivals today. But the onus is not on him, it's on everyone else.
Little glitch on the line there, but we'll try and carry on with this, Jenny, if we can. If Norris is going to win this world title this weekend, do you think he can do it right now? What are his chances? Or do you think we're going to have that grandstand final finish in Abu Dhabi next week?
So everyone I spoke to coming out on the plane is desperate for it to go all the way to Abu Dhabi, for it to be a grandstand finish, as you say. And Norris has given himself a bit of breathing space, hasn't he, by having two chances. He just has to outscore his rivals by 2 points over the course of this weekend, basically leaving here with a 26-point advantage. 25 could be enough, in fact. But once the maths have been finished today after the sprint race, it'll be a slightly easier job to work it out. But you do have to be a bit of a mathematician to work in F1 sometimes. And I'm sure all of these numbers are going through Lando Norris's mind, Oscar Piastri's, and Max Verstappen's mind too. They just have to try and close the gap. And all Lando can do, with the support of his family who are out here, is just try at the first attempt to get this done. If he can, I honestly don't know yet.
Well, look, Jenny, thank you so much for your time this morning. And you can hear full commentary of practice getting underway at 6 p.m. on Sports Extra 2 and on BBC Sounds, with the Qatar Grand Prix starting at 4 p.m. tomorrow on Sports Extra 3. Now, finally, you might just remember this goal that led to one of the most iconic lines of Olympic commentary for Great Britain.
Shawani and Starport makes it three, and the players are off the bench this time. Two goals for Imran Shawani. Where were the Germans? But frankly, who cares?
The wonderful voice there of Barry Davis talking about those incredible goals. Imran Shawani, who led Great Britain to hockey gold at the 1988 Olympics, has died at the age of 63. He scored twice in the final as GB beat West Germany 3-1 in Seoul.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Good to hear that again. It is 28 minutes to 8. Here's Paddy O'Connell with details of tomorrow's Broadcasting House.
Hello. Labour went for tax and spend after all, as Rishi Sunak predicted they would. Where is business and public opinion now? Feedback is asking listeners for the radio interview of 2025. We turn the tables and invite feedback onto BH to listen to some classics.
What have you done to me?
I can only apologise.
No, that's all, no, it's all right, because I put far too much thought into this list.
Advent begins on Sunday. Petroc Trelawney will be our guide as to where to book Christmas concerts. BH is on Sunday on BBC Sounds and Here from 9 on BBC Radio 4.
Always look forward to that. Look at the weather now. Today will be cloudy and wet for southern areas, but turning dry and bright as the day progresses. Showers in the afternoon in central areas with wintry showers in the far north. Sounds great.
You're listening today with Emma Barnett and Simon Jack. And at 27 minutes to 8, a summary of the news from Tom Sanders. Tom.
Asylum seekers are to be banned from using taxpayer-funded taxis to get to medical appointments after journeys of hundreds of miles were revealed by a BBC investigation. An urgent review is launched by ministers after Radio 4's File on 4 investigates found examples of the practice costing hundreds of pounds, including a 250-mile journey to see a GP. Airlines are making urgent modifications to thousands of Airbus planes after the firm discovered intense solar radiation could interfere with onboard flight control computers. There have been warnings of disruption to services worldwide, although many carriers said that they had already resolved the issue. 3 days of official mourning have begun in Hong Kong after a devastating fire ripped through tower blocks on Wednesday, killing at least 128 people. 11 people are under arrest amid allegations of corruption linked to renovation work that was being carried out when the fire started. Ukraine's foreign minister says 2 people have been killed after Russia launched dozens of missiles and hundreds of drones in an attack on the capital Kyiv. Loud explosions were heard across the city as several apartment blocks were hit. Russian authorities have blamed falling debris from a Ukrainian drone for a fire that's broken out at an oil refinery in the Krasnodar region east of Crimea. The Trump administration says that it's halting all asylum decisions in the wake of the shooting in Washington of 2 members of the National Guard, one of whom has died. Wednesday's attack has been blamed on an Afghan national. Earlier, President Trump pledged to permanently pause migration to the US from what he called all third world countries. Pope Leo has visited Istanbul's Blue Mosque on the 3rd day of his trip to Turkey, in his first appearance at a Muslim place of worship since he became the head of the Roman Catholic Church. Later today, the Pope will sign a joint declaration with the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church and join thousands of worshippers for his first public mass outside Italy.
Tom, thanks very much. It's 25 minutes to 8. The Olympian Sir Chris Hoy and former Prime Minister Lord David Cameron are among those well-known men who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer who've criticised the decision to deny a national screening programme for the disease. The UK National Screening Committee said it would not recommend population screening using the prostate-specific antigen PSA test, as it's known, because it's likely to cause more harm than good. Instead, it's recommended that only men considered high risk because of a falsy gene should be tested, and that's because they're put at a far higher risk of prostate cancer. They'll be tested every 2 years between the ages of 45 and 61. That's the plan as it stands, but there is this backlash. Professor Sir Mike Richards is chair of the National Screening Committee and former National Cancer Director for the NHS. And shortly I'll be talking to Nick Jones, founder of the Soho House Group, who made a full recovery after battling prostate cancer following a diagnosis in 2022. He's been campaigning for more men to be tested since, and we've had him on the programme a few times. But first, to come to you, Sir Mike Richards, Professor Sir Mike Richards, good morning.
Good morning.
Likely to cause more harm than good. Can you explain the rationale?
Yes, the National Screening Committee
makes evidence-based recommendations on screening programmes. We look at all the harms, all the benefits, and if the benefits outweigh the harms, we will recommend a programme. We would very much like to recommend a programme for prostate cancer because it is a big killer of men, but at the moment the evidence does not go in favour of that. The harms are that it can leave people with both incontinence and impotence, and the numbers who will be affected by that exceed the numbers considerably that would have their lives saved. Now, there are some lives saved through PSA testing. That is undoubtedly true.
So in terms of when, you know, listeners, those who are not that familiar with this, read about the fact that research also indicates screening could prevent, for instance, 1,500 deaths per year. Is that not true?
We can argue about whether it's 1,500. It would certainly be several hundred lives a year, I believe, that could be saved, whether it's more than that. But against that, it'd probably be several thousand people who would be given the long-term effects of incontinence or impotence. And that's what we're balancing for the population as a whole, and indeed for groups such as black men, who are at higher risk. But we know very little about what happens to them because so few of them have been involved in trials up to now. And that's what we're trying to rectify and rectify rapidly.
So when the question is asked, as you've highlighted, one in four black men will get prostate cancer, double the risk of other men, twice as likely to die from the disease. Why not make screening routinely available to black men as a priority group? What is the answer?
The answer is that actually those figures, we need to absolutely get them clear. We need to see whether the benefits do outweigh the harms in that group. There's a new trial called the Transform trial that's just started, and they are planning to recruit as many black men as they possibly can for that. And that will give us, within 2 to 3 years, it'll give us the answers that we need. And if we get the answers we need, I would certainly then be in favour of changing the recommendation.
Before I go to Nick Jones, how difficult is it? You've got not just one, two former prime ministers, one of whom has been diagnosed with this disease, leading the charge against this, as you say, evidence-based decision. Lord Cameron saying, we're letting down too many men if we don't push for a wider screening programme that includes all high-risk groups.
And I can tell you that I have met with Rishi Sunak on this specifically and had a long conversation with him about it. We differ on our interpretation of the data. That's fine. And that's why we're going out to consultation on this. And I would welcome evidence-based comments back to this consultation.
Is that a very diplomatic way of saying you're finding it rather annoying that people who have either suffered from this and or are former prime ministers not with any medical training are not using evidence?
No, I may say, I haven't previously said this publicly, I have actually had prostate cancer myself. So I do know what it's about from a personal angle, as well as from looking at the evidence. So I can join Lord Cameron in that group and indeed Nick Jones. It's not that I'm against having screening. Of course, I would like to have a screening programme for this condition.
But from your perspective, this is the right road at the moment, from personal perspective as well.
This is the right road for the time being. Remember that men can ask for a PSA test. That is available to them. That is available particularly, I think, for men with a family history. I would encourage them to talk to their GP about that.
If you don't mind me asking, is that how you were diagnosed? Because you asked for it.
Yes, I had symptoms and I had a PSA test, and from that I was diagnosed. And just to complete the story, I have had my prostate removed.
Nick Jones, let me bring you in at this moment. Professor Sir Mike Richards, thank you for being able to share that this morning. I'm sure that must be quite a thing in some ways to share that publicly, especially in the role that you hold. Nick Jones, good morning. It's evidence-based, this decision. What do you say to that?
Well, I wholly disagree with the committee. I think it's a huge missed opportunity. I think the committee is allowing perfection to be the enemy of progress. I'm delighted that Sir Mike has told everyone that he's been through the same battle with prostate cancer as so many other people have. I ask him that he obviously knows about prostate cancer and he knows about PSA and he knew what to do. He knew to go and get a PSA and then to get the MRI and then to have a long, long, long discussion with lots of people after his biopsy on what his treatment options are. So there was no chance that Sir Mike was going to be overtreated. And that is the point I'm making. Things have moved on in the last 5 years. The committee is stuck in the mud. I really question what Sir Mike, why, because he has all that knowledge of prostate cancer, can't other people, particularly men of high risk, black men, people with prostate cancer in the family, have the right to having a letter to nudge them along? People who might not be fully informed, people who might not know what's going on. And I'm going to be, if his committee has said no, so it's now down to Wes Streeting.
We'll come back to that in a moment. So, Mike Richards, I do have to let you respond to that. Why not just a letter to nudge people along? I mean, of course, that leads to a screening programme. I'm not saying it doesn't, but what do you say to that?
The implication of having a screening programme and sending a letter out to men is that we believe the benefits outweigh the harms. And at the moment, we do not believe that. There have been improvements that Nick was alluding to. MRI has made improvements, not as big as some people claim, but it has made improvements. It is still difficult, even when you've had the MRI and the biopsy, to differentiate between those cancers that will never cause trouble and those that are aggressive. For some, it's very easy to tell, but for others, it is not. So there are still men who will, after a biopsy, be recommended to have treatment or will choose to have treatment, who would never have been troubled by prostate cancer if they'd never had the PSA test or the biopsy. So it is a very difficult balance here.
Do you think you are getting the right balance, though? Nick's saying the perfection is getting in the way of progress and that you're stuck in the mud.
We are absolutely not looking for perfection on this. And I think we demonstrate that by the group that we have recommended it for, the men who are carriers of BRCA gene variants. They are at higher risk. They have more aggressive disease and they have it at a younger age. Or it's those three factors together that mean that we do believe that there is more benefit than harm for that group.
Nick, are you convinced of any of that?
No, I think there are a huge amount of experts in the field who strongly disagree with the committee's recommendations. And I want to hear what Mike is going to say to the black men of Britain.
Mike, final word to you? It's a question.
First of all, I don't actually think it is a huge number of the prostate cancer specialists. The large number that come to me and say, you've made the right recommendation. I've had that. I can't tell you how many messages I've had about that in the last 24 hours. So, and for black men, we've got to make sure that for black men, the balance really is the benefits would outweigh the harms. If we can demonstrate that, and we can demonstrate that within the next couple of years, I believe then we may be in a position to say, yes, we think that is right. But otherwise, we risk actually doing more harm to black men than we would be doing to white men. So we cannot do that until we've got the evidence.
Professor Sir Mike Richards, Nick Jones, thank you to both of you.
7:45, the UK's first major exhibition created by blind and partially blind artists has just opened, and it seeks to challenge the way we think about and experience art. Beyond the Visual at the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds questions the dominance of sight in the art world through a series of sculptures and installations made to be experienced through other senses, touch, sound, even smell. We went along with the blind comedian and host of Radio 4's Life on the Blink, Jamie McDonald, who acted as our guide.
That's like me walking through scaffolding with my head. Like every blind person knows the various noises of bus stop to the face, lamppost to the head, and just one off the chest. Yeah, that's very cool. Hi, I am stand-up comedian Jamie McDonald. I am here at the Beyond the Visual art exhibition in Leeds at the Henry Moore Institute, and this is art that is specifically made for and by blind and visually impaired people. There's been nothing really I've ever found that's been laid on specifically for people, so it's quite exciting, and I've got high expectations.
Turn to your left now.
Sophie has been kind enough, she is leading me round the exhibition today. This seems like this is mad.
So this is, it's a wooden and, hang on, that's a kind of wire structure. It almost feels like a maze, but it's on a, like a kind of bouncy pivot. And it's got, it does that when you move it. Okay, it's noisy. It's like a, I mean, I would put that as almost like a massive, almost like a child's toy. That'd be about right.
That's actually what it's based on. Not a child's toy, but skimming toys. A lot of neurodivergent people like to use sensory toys.
Oh, right. Well, yeah, okay.
So this work can be spun a bit like a skimming toy and make similar sounds as well.
You're kind of stuck in this specific locale. I suppose you could translate that into eyesight. People with, you know, very bad eyesight, they can fully express themselves, but we are limited in what we can do.
Follow my arm. There's a stool with no back in front of you.
This is dangerous. This is high up. Okay. So I sit on this stool?
Yes, this you want to. And I'd encourage you to feel underneath the table where you're sat. Maybe along the edges.
You sweating, that's the chewing gum from under a school desk. Yes.
It's
and it smells of mint.
Yes. He's actually scented the work with a peppermint smell.
He certainly has. Oh, that's the wee lumps of chewing gum familiar to anybody that went to school in the 90s and put a blob of gum under the desk. And it was better that than on the seat. And the smell of mint, that does remind me of being at high school.
There's a ton of other visually impaired folk here, and it'd be quite interesting to see what they think about it all.
My name is Lindsay Moore, and I'm a singer and guide. I'm going to hear today with Iris. I didn't sort of have any preconceived ideas of what it would be like. There's lots of pieces that you can actually get hands on. There's a brilliant piece of art which is all about sort of different bells and sizes and different tones when you can sort of hit them with a hammer. And I liked that one. And my guide dog Iris, her tail wagged frantically with that. She rather liked that one as well.
My name is David Johnson. I'm a blind artist. I've got two pieces here, one called Nuggets of Embodiment, the biscuit piece, and the other called Inhibition, the chewing gum piece.
I sat down at the desk,
yeah,
and memories of school, straight away. I forgot that the actual desk did stink of chewing gum that was under it. And then there it is, the little lumps of chewing gum. So
The chewing gum bits are actually silicon. Bits of silicon stuck to the underside of that tabletop. And they're hidden, they're inhibited. And that's the idea, really, because so much in a blind person's life is hidden or obscure.
Have you been round the other,
no,
other bits?
No, yeah.
I think you've probably found there's quite a lot of, like, basically, expression, but within very tight confines, which I find about kind of blindness. The people here clearly have skill and imagination, and they are making, undoubtedly, very, very interesting, thought-provoking pieces of art, and I would recommend anyone go to see it as well. And people with sight, yeah, you guys deserve a break as well.
That was comedian Jamie McDonald there. Beyond the Visual is at the Henry Moore Institute in Leeds until April.
It's 10 to 8. Now it is time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning, the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welwyn Garden City.
Good morning, Emma. Morning, Simon. Well, today, churches and cathedrals across the country are making their final preparations for Advent. For Christians, it's a glorious time. The season offers a complete alternative to the increasingly premature, noisy Christmas build-up. Because Advent invites us to pause, to breathe, to wait, some respite from the noise of any worry or concerns. The world was a different place in 1964 when Simon and Garfunkel first released their global hit celebrating The Sound of Silence. Yet even then, they were drawing attention to the relentless noise of daily life, how people choose superficial distractions instead of genuine human connection. Adrian Childs, now also of this parish, recently wrote a memorable article in The Guardian where he observed, "Our world is getting noisier. The sheer racket, the crashes, bangs and wallops, the engines, the yelling, the bings and bongs of phone alerts." He's definitely right. I don't know if it's just me that dreads getting the last train home on a Friday night after, say, a theatre visit. For instance, last weekend I couldn't hear myself think and suddenly realised how calamitous and disruptive the sheer din of my carriage was. But everyone just kind of accepts it as a new norm. It reminded me also of a young person who came into our parish church a few weeks ago, and she asked innocently, "Is there any time when I can come in here simply for some silence?" "That's all I need," she said. I explained that some of our services are certainly quieter than others, but as I searched for a genuinely helpful response, I realised that the truthful answer was no, and it's a gap I'm determined to address in the new year. Being silent before the Lord was a command made by the prophet Zechariah, and of course the books of the Bible make frequent reference to the spiritual renewal that being still and the resulting silence can bring. Indeed, the Catholic writer Maria Boulding, reflecting on Advent, challenges that anything we can do to help people recover a sense of silence, as necessary and positive as elements in human life, is a contribution to human sanity. Well, my Advent hope is simply to rediscover a little bit of that healing gift of silence. That'll certainly be my intention as I light the first Advent candle tomorrow. There is, of course, always a time for everything, including a time for joyful noise, but there is also a time for the sound of silence. And for our sanity, we need both.
Thanks very much indeed, Rob. It is 7 minutes to eight. It always takes a few days for people to unpack the contents of a budget. Who'll be affected? Unexpected outcomes, what the markets make of it. But with this one, there's some added intrigue. Rachel Reeves has been accused of knowingly exaggerating the parlous state of the public finances in the run-up to the budget. The Chancellor strongly suggested they were so bad she might have to break a manifesto pledge and raise the rate of income tax, when the OBR hadn't told her, in fact, that while she would have been uncomfortably close to missing her own fiscal rules, there was, in fact, no gaping black hole. It was more of a divot she needed to fill. In the event, she raised taxes by £26 billion, raising spending and giving herself a bigger buffer against future shocks. To look at the process and the end product, Rain Newton-Smith, Director General of the Confederation of British Industry. Good morning to you, Rain. Just on the process, we've had people saying that the sort of chaos, the U-turns, now this unseemly spat, it seems, between the Treasury and the OBR, doesn't do much for confidence. What are you hearing?
Well, I think what we've heard from business leaders is the endless speculation ahead of this budget seemed to go on for a hugely long amount of time. And we had a very late budget in the year, and that was damaging for business confidence. I think businesses were holding their breath to see what decisions were taken. But I think moving forward, what they want to see and what hopefully we will get from this budget is that the Chancellor has put in place more fiscal headroom of £22 billion. So we'll be out of this groundhog day of every 6 months speculation around a budget, which will lead to higher taxes and people holding back from those critical decisions that drive investment in our country.
I mean, business bore the brunt of the last big sort of tax raid in the previous budget. Were you braced for more as a result of the pitch rolling that went on, and or are you sort of, you know, net sort of relieved that you didn't get the clobbering you did last time?
Well, I think one of the things we were very clear on is we couldn't see an increase in business taxation similar to what we saw last year, because that raised the overall burden on business by £24 billion a year. And we're seeing the impact in a slowing labour market. But I think so the fact that in this budget, the Chancellor kept her corporate tax roadmap, there had been quite a lot of speculation that she might raise taxes on our financial services, which would have increased the cost of capital and led to lower investment. And the burden on financial services at the moment means we're not competitive internationally. So some decisions weren't taken, which I think business will breathe a sigh of relief. But I think generally what I hear from businesses is they want to see an increase in the pace of delivery on some of the infrastructure spending the government have committed to. They want to see more of a focus on adult skills and retraining. They need a solution on energy costs. So I think this certainly isn't job done. But I'd say the other thing we have to remember is it isn't only about budgets. I think budgets obviously are often about tax raising measures, not always about spending. And I think this week we've also seen a pretty landmark decision on a change in the Employment Rights Bill, which not having a meaningful probation period meant that businesses were worried that creating jobs would be much riskier, creating opportunities would be riskier. So I think that was a huge step forward.
That's a very interesting one. Basically, there was quite a hefty pay rise for on the national living wage, particularly for 18 to 20 year olds. The flip side of that is the next day, the unfair dismissal rights don't start from day one as promised, but from month six. Do you think the challenge to your members is then go out and hire some people? If this is really why you've not been hiring people, we've taken this uncertainty out, get on and hire. The onus will now be on business to deliver.
Well, look, obviously businesses were part of those critical negotiations to find a more lasting consensus around the employment rights bill. So many will be breathing a sigh of relief. But you're right. Look, the overall cost of employment has gone up significantly. I think everyone wants to support the increases in the national living wage, but they are very ambitious at 4% across the board, and obviously much higher for young people at an increase of 10%. And when businesses are trying to accommodate that, and we're not seeing enough of the growth and investment and productivity that supports those rises over the long term, it is hard. And if you're a pub with dealing with business rates rises alongside that, it is difficult. So, okay. But I do think taking away or allowing for meaningful probation periods will make things a lot easier for business going forward.
We shall see. Rae Newton-Smith, Director General of the CBI. And we'll bring up some of the spat around the budget with Gillian Tett and Rachel Sylvester in our panel later in the programme.
We will indeed. Now, on Tuesday morning, we'll hear the next in this year's Reef Lecture Series.
Most of us want to be seen and admired.
The 2025 Reef Lectures continue.
But in our society today, we admire the wrong things and the wrong people.
The historian Rutger Bregman delivers the second of his lectures on moral revolution.
What the British abolitionist taught me is that it is possible to rewrite a nation's honour code.
Considering how small groups of committed people can change the world for the better.
Our goal should be to make future historians proud.
The 2025 Reef Lectures
on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds continues this Tuesday morning at 9.
Time for a quick look at the weather. Elizabeth Rizzini is at the Weather Centre. Good morning.
Good morning, Simon. It's a much drier, brighter day in store for us tomorrow, but today there's some heavy rain, and that's mostly across England and Wales. It's all pushing further eastwards. There could be some very heavy downpours at times. There certainly are. Some of that could lead to some flooding. It's developing area of low pressure. It's going to pull out into the North Sea later on this evening. So it's already a wet start to the day for many of us. We'll see brisk winds down through eastern facing coast a little later on through the day as well. Maybe a bit of snow over the Pennines and the Welsh Mountains. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, though, while there's some rain towards the southeast, then it's looking largely dry here for much of the rest of the day, and there'll even be some brightness around at times too. It's cold in the north, 3 to 8 degrees Celsius, but milder further south, where we could get to 7 to 10 or even 11 degrees Celsius.
Elizabeth, thanks very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Simon Jack and Emma Barnett.
It's 8 o'clock on Saturday the 29th of November. The headlines this morning. The government is to stop funding the use of taxis to take asylum seekers to medical appointments after journeys costing hundreds of pounds were revealed by a BBC investigation. More on that at 10 past 8. Airlines around the world are working to install a software update on thousands of planes after Airbus said solar radiation could cause some flight controls to malfunction. And Hong Kong is observing 3 days of mourning for those killed in the city's deadliest fire in more than 70 years.
Also coming up on the programme, my personal story of the year. After learning when they were teenagers she would never be able to carry a child due to a rare condition, Georgia Barrington's best friend promised that one day she would have her baby for her. Remarkably, Daisy Hope made good on that teenage promise, and now the baby is here.
No one else will ever have what we have had. Like, no one else will be able to tell stories of how their daughter came into the world in this way. And I just feel so lucky. And every time I look at her, I'm so grateful.
We'll hear from Georgia and her best friend Daisy in their first interview since baby Otterly safely arrived.
I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport, and in the next half hour we'll hear the latest from Australia as England captain Ben Stokes defends any accusations his side are arrogant.
But first, the BBC News is read by Tom Sanders.
The government is to ban the use of taxis funded by the taxpayer to take asylum seekers to medical appointments after ministers launched an urgent review in response to a BBC investigation earlier this year. Radio 4's File on 4 Investigates found examples of the practice costing hundreds of pounds, including a 250-mile round journey. Here's our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
The BBC revealed earlier this year that taxis were being used for journeys, such as to doctor's appointments, sometimes hundreds of miles away, at an expense of hundreds of pounds. The Home Office announced a review in response, and now the use of taxis is to be banned from February for medical travel. There will be limited exemptions, including for people with physical disabilities and pregnancy-related needs, but these will have to be approved by the Home Office. The Home Secretary said that would only happen in the most exceptional circumstances and that she would continue to root out waste. There are other examples where taxis are sometimes used, such as when people are moved between accommodation. The Home Office is continuing to review that situation but wants to expand the principle that taxis are only used in extraordinary circumstances. It's also been revealed today that the average annual cost of all forms of transport for asylum seekers is £15.8 million.
Airlines are making urgent modifications to thousands of Airbus planes after the firm discovered intense solar radiation could interfere with onboard flight control computers. The issue affects the A320 family of aircraft, one of the most widely used models in the world. Passengers have been warned of possible disruption, although many airlines said they had already resolved the issue. Nick Johnson reports.
Last month, a JetBlue flight from Cancun in Mexico to Newark in the United States experienced a sudden drop in altitude. Airbus said radiation from the sun was found to interfere with sensors critical to the aircraft's flight controls. Action is now being taken to prevent a similar incident, with more than 6,000 Airbus planes thought to be vulnerable to the same problem. For many affected aircraft, the issue can be resolved with a straightforward software update. EasyJet says it's already completed the fix and expects to operate normally today. Heathrow and Manchester Airport say they do not expect widespread disruption, while Gatwick says some delays are possible. In a statement, the Transport Secretary Heidi Alexander said the impact on UK airlines appeared to be limited. She's urged passengers due to fly this weekend to check with their airline for the latest information.
3 days of official mourning have begun in Hong Kong after a devastating fire ripped through several tower blocks on Wednesday. Government officials stood outside the headquarters to observe a 3-minute silence in memory of the 128 people known to have died. From Hong Kong, Danny Vincent reports.
Flags at all government offices are flying at half-mast as people across Hong Kong mourn those killed in the world's worst residential building fire in decades. A number of condolence books have been set up throughout the city for people to sign. King Charles has sent a message of support, saying he and the Queen were greatly saddened by what he called an appalling tragedy. Officials are working at the scene of the fire to confirm the identities of victims and collect evidence for an investigation into how it began. The number of victims is expected to rise as around 200 people remain unaccounted for. The authorities have arrested 11 people in connection with the blaze, with investigators focusing on possible corruption and the unsafe use of building materials.
The Trump administration says it's halting all asylum decisions in the wake of the shooting in Washington of 2 members of the National Guard, one of whom has died. Wednesday's attack has been blamed on an Afghan national. From Washington, here's our North America correspondent, Sean Dilley.
Writing on social media, the head of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency, Joseph Edlow, said all asylum decisions had been halted until officials could be sure that every alien would be vetted to the maximum degree possible. A short time later, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio confirmed that no new visas would be issued to people travelling on an Afghan passport. Both announcements come the day after the death of a National Guard soldier, Sarah Beckstrom. The 20-year-old was one of 2 guards shot near the White House on Wednesday. The suspected killer is an Afghan national who entered the U.S. in 2021 as part of a program recognizing his service alongside U.S. forces in Afghanistan. He was granted asylum earlier this year. President Trump says Joe Biden's administration failed to thoroughly vet immigrants to the U.S.
The authorities in Ukraine say a Russian drone attack on the capital Kyiv has killed two people and injured several others. Loud explosions were heard across the city as several apartment blocks were hit overnight. Reports suggest Ukrainian negotiators will visit the United States this weekend for talks with American officials on President Trump's plan to end the war with Russia. President Putin has said a US team is due to hold discussions in Moscow next week. The author of an independent review of the carers' allowance benefits has told Radio 4's Moneybox programme that the government must set about implementing her recommendations at pace. Liz Sace found that confusing guidance on carers' allowance, which is given to those providing at least 35 hours of unpaid care a week, has left thousands of people with fines and surprise bills. Here's Dan Whitworth from Moneybox.
Carers UK has welcomed this report as a landmark moment for people who care for loved ones, often with severe physical or learning disabilities. Key recommendations include reassessing nearly 200,000 cases where carers have been pushed into debt, committing to simplifying a complicated claim system, and acknowledging how carers have been let down by confusing rules for many years. By no means will every carer in debt have that cancelled or reduced, but by accepting what campaigners have argued for so long, that the system fundamentally let carers down, the government has taken huge steps towards putting things right. The government said carers deserved a benefit that reflected their vital contribution to society and that it was determined to fix problems with carers' allowance it inherited.
A new left-wing party set up by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana will officially launch in Liverpool today. It's been provisionally called Your Party, but its permanent name is to be agreed by members this weekend. The inaugural conference will also see a decision on whether or not to have a conventional party leader. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
There have been questions about whose party is your party. The former Labour MP, Zara Sultana, announced the intention to set it up in July, before the former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, was quite ready to announce it. She then launched a membership drive, which Mr Corbyn's supporters said was unauthorised, and there are ongoing tensions over party funds. The new movement is currently leaderless and may even stay that way, at least in a conventional sense. As well as deciding on its formal name, its members will decide this weekend whether to have a single leader. If that's the decision, it would likely lead to a potentially divisive contest between Mr Corbyn and Ms Sultana. So the members may opt instead to be led by a committee, which is chaired by someone who isn't a sitting MP. That would certainly be distinctive, but it's not clear yet whether that would amount to conflict avoidance or conflict resolution.
The former hockey player Imran Shewani, who is one of the stars of the Great Britain team that won gold at the Seoul Olympics in 1988, has died at the age of 63. He was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2019. Imran Shewani scored twice in the Olympic final as Great Britain beat West Germany 3-1, with his second goal prompting a patriotic reaction from the BBC commentator Barry Davis.
Bachelor of Southgate, and Shewani, a star forward, makes it three, and the players are off the bench this time. Two goals for Imran Shewani. Where were the Germans? But frankly, who cares?
In a statement, Great Britain Hockey said Imran Shewani's talent, leadership and humility had inspired generations of players.
Tom, thank you very much. It's 10 minutes past eight. Following an urgent review prompted by a Radio 4 investigation that was on the network's File on 4 programme called Inside the Migrant Hotel, the government says it will ban the use of taxis for asylum seekers travelling to most of their medical appointments from February. It's also been revealed that the Home Office spends nearly £16 million a year on such transportation. In September, we reported that asylum seekers were sometimes travelling long distances at a cost of hundreds of pounds and using taxis for short journeys from hotels to nearby appointments, and this then prompted that review. Sue Mitchell spent the summer investigating migrant hotels for Radio 4 as protests took place outside of them and asked taxi drivers what the public would make of the widespread use of cabs.
I don't think that ever gets mentioned because I don't think they're aware.
What do you mean?
I don't think, you know, like, everybody's aware that they're up here. I don't think then they moan or they get taxis everywhere because I just don't think people know.
Would they moan if they did know, do you think?
Yeah.
Well, shortly I'll be hearing from a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee. But Sue Mitchell, our reporter, is here now. Morning.
Morning, Emma.
widespread taxi use, seriously widespread use, was one of the most surprising things that you found in your investigation leading to this urgent government review.
Yes, we heard how they were used to transport people long distances when they moved between hotels in different parts of the country. And if they had NHS appointments, they might be transported back to where they'd been staying. In one example, a 250-mile round trip for a hospital appointment, the taxi driver said the cost to the Home Office would be around £600 for that trip.
And following
our investigation, the Home Secretary announced an urgent review into the use of taxis by asylum seekers. The conclusion of that isn't published yet, but the Home Office has now revealed that the cost of all transport for asylum seekers is around £15.8 million per year. From February, taxis won't be used for medical appointments unless there's a particular need, like pregnancy or disability, say.
So around £15.8 million per year. That's the level it's been put at. And those taxi costs, as well as journeys that caught people's eye, especially the ones being made with no passengers.
I know, that was so surprising. And I've kept looking into that. So after our File and Full investigation aired, I was contacted by taxi drivers who'd done lots of journeys to and from migrant hotels. One of those drivers, Steve, was telling me that he'd sometimes travel long distances to transfer asylum seekers between hotels or detention centres, and they wouldn't get in the car, but their journeys were still charged to the Home Office.
I was averaging about 250 to 275 miles a day. More than once, I went from Gatwick to Southampton, and I'd be sitting there, and they'd come back and say, oh, look, don't worry, they don't want to go. And they basically refused to move. It just logistically wasn't thought out very well. And I think it was left open to abuse.
It seems there was no effective monitoring by the Home Office of the journeys and the costs. There were three different companies with 10-year contracts to provide accommodation for asylum seekers across the UK. And they outsourced things like food and transport to other firms. Steve was saying that he thinks this makes it easier for them to inflate the mileage. He says drivers could be sent over long distances, say. They'd take passengers somewhere that was maybe even close to the hotel, and a second driver would then be dispatched to bring them back from that same appointment. He said a round trip he made cost nearly, it was 100 miles, and he thinks it costs, well over £100, and that was just to take an asylum seeker to see a dentist.
And it was only about a mile and a half from his hotel. And after 20 minutes, I got a phone call from the control centre.
Because you were going to wait. The plan was you were going
to
wait.
I was going to wait to take you back to the hotel.
Yeah.
And they said to me, no, we need you back at Gatwick. So they sent me from Gatwick to Reading for a mile and a half journey, sent me back to Gatwick, and then sent this guy from Heathrow to Reading to pick him up.
And you think that was done to basically maximise the number of drivers making these long journeys?
I definitely do. It was ridiculous. It was absolutely ridiculous.
It's worth saying Steve's one of several drivers with concerns about journey charging. He thinks about half of his daily mileage was made without a passenger.
I'm just taking that in. What else is the Home Office saying?
It says it's still reviewing the wider use of taxis for non-medical appointments. There's something it's not saying too, which is the cost of transport in the past year. The figure it's given, £15.8 million, is an average over recent years. Whenever I've asked how much it's spent in the last year, the Home Office has declined to answer. And we learned this week that the number of people in migrant hotels has gone up from 32,000 in June to 36,000 in September. So it's possible that the transport bill has gone up too.
Sue Mitchell, thank you very much for bringing us up today and reporting the latest on this. As we came into this, just to remind you, the government has said it will ban the use of taxis for asylum seekers travelling to most medical appointments. That's going to be effective from February and marks a serious change from what you hear has become the norm. Paul Kohler is a Liberal Democrat MP and a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee and joins us now. Paul, what's your reaction, first of all, to the ban?
I'm shocked, but not surprised. I'm pleased with the ban, because the money wasted is an absolutely shocking indictment of the contract signed under the previous Tory government.
But it's also trying to understand why that was decided as well, isn't it? And how we came to this position, a bit like with the hotels. But it's quite hard to understand that and get an answer.
It's exactly the same issue. It's the same contract. The contract that was signed was a cost-plus contract, which allowed the providers to have a fixed percentage profit on the money spent. They had an incentive to spend more money and no incentive to save money. So what happened? They spent money on taxes. It's ridiculous.
Was there anything around security? I don't know if you've looked at this as a committee around putting asylum seekers in taxis versus on the bus or on the train like everyone else?
I don't think that was thought through at all. When we talked to the Home Office, they just hadn't thought about the contracts. It never dawned on them that it was a huge incentive to simply spend money.
And I suppose this then puts into that bigger context of what's going on with hotels, the transfer to military-style centres, and also how fast processing happens.
That's the point. The real issue is the fact that we're taking so long to process these asylum applicants. And that's what we need to solve. We need to clear the backlog, which is why we want to introduce Nightingale centres to actually employ new caseworkers to actually clear the backlog.
And these centres, how much will they cost? How will they work?
For by the money we're saving on the money we're wasting on asylum hotels. We're wasting £6 million on asylum hotels every day. Since Labour have been in power, the number in asylum hotels has gone up by 22%. That's ridiculous.
I mean, when I have interviewed members of the government on this, they have talked about it taking time. They are looking at this as fast as they can. Yes, the numbers, as Sue's just outlined, are going in the wrong direction, but it takes time to get new accommodation set up and grip the issue, they would say. I'm paraphrasing.
But if we actually cleared the backlog, we wouldn't need to worry about the accommodation. We would solve this issue by simply dealing with the applications. We're not dealing with them.
There has been concern, though, I suppose, just looking at the words of Alp Mehmet, who's the chairman of the Migration Watch think tank, pushing for lower migration levels of your plan, these so-called Nightingale centres, saying that could make things worse. Speeding up claims will simply encourage more people to come here by whatever means to claim asylum. He thinks it's more about a clear deterrent.
Well, We need to address the applications. I don't accept the fact that our policy would increase. The issue is, of course, the Dublin Accord. If we were still within the Dublin Accord, we wouldn't have this problem. It's all a direct result of us leaving the EU that caused these problems in the first place. There was no incentive to have people coming over the channel when we were within the Dublin Accord. What we need to do is re-engage with Europe and go back into the Dublin Accord.
Well, but if that isn't on the table, which it doesn't seem to be, I suppose it doesn't make your plan sound like it is workable and there's concerns.
Well, we have people coming over. We need to address that, those applications. We need this. The sooner we get those sorted, the better. Return those who haven't got a right to stay, and those who do have a right to stay should be allowed to stay, of course.
How quickly do you think, just now coming back to your position on the Home Affairs Select Committee with the conversations you've had, how quickly do you think the government can get a grip of this,
both with
transportation and accommodation?
Well, there's break clauses on the contracts next year. They should exercise the break clauses. They've shown no indication whether they're going to yet. We've called on that in the Home Affairs Select Committee. We're waiting to see whether they will do. So they've got to get out of these contracts. That's the first thing
they need to do.
Yeah, the hotel contracts, which include the transport as well.
It does. It's all in one.
Yeah.
Paul Kohler, Liberal Democrat MP, member of the Home Affairs Select Committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
19 minutes past eight. Wherever Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky goes, his imposing right-hand man and chief of staff, Andriy Yermak, is never far behind. Until yesterday, when Zelensky's trusted lieutenant, the man leading the peace negotiations, resigned following an anti-corruption raid on his home, even though he's not been accused of any wrongdoing. So what will losing such a key figure at such a sensitive time for the negotiations and for President Zelensky himself? Well, I've been speaking to Simon Schuster, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He's also the author of The Showman, a book about the rise of Volodymyr Zelensky. He spoke to Mr. Yermak just the day before he resigned. I asked him whether he had a sense then that he was going to have to stand down, even though, of course, he's admitted no wrongdoing.
I would guess that he probably had some sense that something like this was about to happen. I did have the sense during our conversation that he was trying to secure his position as the chief negotiator and the chief of staff to President Zelensky by reminding the people of Ukraine that this is his role and it would be detrimental to the country to allow anything to interfere with his very important work as a negotiator. But here we are.
And just how does it affect that role? Because it couldn't come at a more sensitive time.
It's hard to say what role it's going to play in the negotiations. I'd say there are some negatives, some positives. The negatives are that he has been the head of the negotiating team for some time, really throughout the full-scale war over the last almost 4 years. He's been the main negotiator representing President Zelensky on the global stage. But I think it does also relieve some tension, because I know from speaking to European diplomats and some American officials that they were really pressuring Zelensky to fire Yermak. So I think it could ease some tension in the relationship, but you know, it also hurts because you need to bring in a new team, and there's always a new team of negotiators that need to get caught up. And that always takes some time and can be difficult. So it's hard to say at this point if it's a net positive or a net negative.
There have been accusations of corruption of public figures in Ukraine for some time. Does this get uncomfortably close now to Zelensky's own front door?
Definitely. I mean, the fact that the investigators arrived at the doorstep of Andriy Yermak, President Zelensky's closest aide, his dear friend, his closest confidant for years now, is very, very close to home for the president. But there hasn't been any indication that the investigation implicates Zelensky directly. And if you listen carefully to what the head of the investigative team there in the anti-corruption agency in Ukraine says, he has consistently pointed out that they are trying to help President Zelensky clean up the system, to make the system more healthy. So there's really nothing in the investigation or the statements from the investigators so far that would suggest they are gunning for Zelensky personally. But they were gunning for Yermak.
He was a very close confidant of Zelensky's. Does this show a kind of ruthless side to Zelensky?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose this summer we saw the ruthless side. This summer we saw President Zelensky step in to try to hinder the investigation. He tried to take away the independence of the agency that was running the investigation against some of his closest allies, and he tried to strip that agency of its power. He backed off only when the people of Ukraine really resisted and there were street protests, and he also got a lot of pushback from his allies in Europe.
And what will Zelensky miss? What did Yermak do for Zelensky that he will miss?
Yeah, I mean, I got to know both men quite well over the years, and I know that Zelensky really appreciated Yermak as a very effective manager. He did what the president wanted. When Zelensky would express a ambition or a goal, Yermak was very good at executing that goal quite creatively and often aggressively in a way that won both of them many enemies within the Ukrainian elites. But I think he will miss the effectiveness of his now former chief of staff in carrying out his wishes.
And just on the bigger picture, the negotiations which are going on, really about drawing the boundaries of Ukraine for the future. And did Yermak have good relationship with Steve Witkoff, for example? Where does this leave the negotiation?
It's interesting. So I talked to Yermak yesterday. He gave me a call and he wanted to draw a line in the negotiations. Maybe he suspected that he was about to be fired. Maybe he suspected that the anti-corruption investigators were on the way and about to raid his home. But he, in the call with me yesterday, made very clear one thing, that Ukraine will not trade away its territory in these negotiations. He drew a very clear red line. And I don't think he would have done that without the say-so of his boss, President Zelensky. So that really constrains and limits the room for maneuver, the room for the negotiators to reach a peace deal, because he set out this point that Ukraine will not trade land for peace.
And that would seem to be putting them at an impasse with the Russian position.
Yes.
Simon Schuster, staff writer at The Atlantic, many thanks, and author of The Showman.
Thank you.
It's 25 minutes past eight. Sarah Orchard here again with the latest on the sport.
Morning.
A very good morning to you. Right, the England captain Ben Stokes has been speaking for the first time since their defeat in the first Ashes test in Perth a week ago. His message? Call us rubbish if you like. Don't call us arrogant. England have had plenty of criticism after they lost within 2 days, throwing away a potentially winning position at lunch on day two. The squad trained in Brisbane for the first time today and Stokes was unexpectedly put up to speak to the media. Our chief cricket reporter, Stefan Schemmelt, spoke to him and will join us shortly. But here is Stokes reflecting on those first 2 days in Perth.
Could we have been better at executing what we wanted to do? Definitely. But again, you know, we've got a mindset of playing the game, which is, you know, looking to put the opposition under pressure, but also trying to absorb that. And sometimes when you go out there and you make a decision, it doesn't always pay out or work in the way that you want it to. And that's what the key for the rest of the tour is making sure that we stay true to our beliefs of how we play our cricket. But also, we do know that we could have definitely been a lot better in certain areas throughout that test match. Call us rubbish, call us whatever you want to be. And, you know, the test match that we wanted to, again, you know, we were great in passages of that game. But yeah, I think arrogant might be a little bit too far, but yeah, that's okay. We'll take the rough with the smooth, but yeah, I'd rather, you know, the words like rubbish, but arrogant, sometimes you're a bit like, oh, not too sure about that one.
Certainly when you started as captain, the fact that quite a strong connection with the fans because of the way you were playing and the results that you were achieving, are you aware that you've got to keep that connection strong through results and performances?
Oh, definitely. It's a results-based, you know, job that we're in. We love our fans. We know we've got an incredible fan base who come out here and support us, and they want to see us win. We want to win. We're absolutely desperate. They're absolutely desperate. So in terms of, you know, that wavelength, we're all on the same wavelength. And look, we know that there'll be a lot of disappointed fans in England after that first defeat, but it's a 5-game series. We've got 4 games to go. We've lost the first one. You know, and we're absolutely desperate to, you know, come home with that goal before we even started the series, which is to win the Ashes. And we'll be doing absolutely everything within our powers and using our time as best to allow us to go out there to try and achieve that goal.
Well, that was the England captain Ben Stokes speaking to our chief cricket reporter Stefan Schemmelt, who joins us now from Brisbane. Good morning.
Hi, Sarah. How you doing?
Good, thank you. Yes, enjoyed that on the TMS podcast this morning on my way in. Lots of eyebrows apparently raised when Stokes was doing the media rounds today. How significant was it?
Yeah, I thought it was important because we hadn't heard from Ben Stokes for a week, and the way that England lost that test match and then the vacuum, I think, of information, particularly around that decision not to send players to Canberra, they were losing a little bit of a PR war, really. Ben Stokes was accused of being a bit tetchy in his post-match interview last week. That's understandable. They'd just suffered a heavy defeat. His head was probably spinning, and I think he had things to get off his chest. He was measured, he was composed, he was conciliatory. And I think actually he showed himself to be in a good frame of mind going into that second test, the day-nighter at the Gabba on Thursday.
And you talk about sending messages. Do you think part of that was maybe sending a message to the fans?
Yeah, absolutely, because there was anger around the way that England lost that game last week, both at home, people who'd stayed up, you know, through all hours to watch the game, and people who'd spent a lot of money to travel to Perth, some of them for a trip of a lifetime. We'd heard that some had been saving money for 20 years to get here for this game, and they only saw 2 days of cricket. And you could say, well, you pay your money, you take your choice, would you be happy if England had won in 2 days? But they didn't, and it was bad last Saturday, as bad as it's been for England, I think, in Australia. And so Ben Stokes, yeah, he does know that he needs to keep the support of the England supporters on side through performances and results.
And just lastly, you mentioned that slightly tetchy interview with Jonathan Agnew at the end of that test. Much of that was all around whether they should or shouldn't be going to Canberra for this pink ball game. He actually answered some of those questions, didn't he?
He did, and he gave reasons that we knew already, really. Different conditions in Canberra, both the pitch, the climate, different to what they'd get here in Brisbane, where it's really hot, pace and bounce, and just that England wanted to keep the team together for reasons of camaraderie and spirit. But for the first time, Stokes said, you know what, I do understand the other side of the argument, why people think we should have gone to Canberra, but look, we've made this decision, we think we've made it for good reasons, and we're doing this because we feel this is the best way to prepare for that second test match.
Stefan Schermalt, thank you so much for your time. You can hear more from Ben Stokes then on the TMS podcast out now on BBC Sounds. If you do want to follow that Prime Minister's 11 fixture, that's on Sports Extra right now. And don't forget, Sports Extra 3 will be the place where you can hear full commentary tomorrow of the Qatar Grand Prix as Britain's Lando Norris goes for that Formula One title.
Interesting that sportsmen would rather be called rubbish than arrogant.
I think
that's an interesting choice there. But let us talk to someone who's neither, Adrian Childs, who's got Saturday Live after 9 o'clock. Adrian, morning.
Good morning to you. On Saturday Live today, we have Ben Miller, exceptionally talented man, comedian, actor, writer, accomplished student of physics in his time. Another talented person, Lucy Steeds, a writer, an author. No tales from her of 10, 20 rejections for various first efforts of novels. Debut novel has won the Waterstones Book of the Year prize. And we're looking forward to talking to her about the artist and what it takes to write something critically acclaimed like that. Also speaking to Grace Vella. Dreamt of a career as a professional footballer, didn't make it, so thought, whatever, I'm going to be a success in business instead. And she did that by finding the need for football apparel for women, because, newsflash, women have different requirements in that department. Also today, Holly McRae, daughter of Colin, on Getting Behind the Wheels, 30 years to the day since her dad clinched the World Rally Championship. And also we have the inheritance tracks of Chris and Zand van Tolleken.
Looking forward to it, Adrian. Thanks very much. Yes, we do have different needs in that department. I love the way that was described about women in football attire. Now, looking at the weather, today will be cloudy and wet for southern areas, but turning dry and bright as the day progresses. Showers in the afternoon in central areas, with wintry showers in the far north.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Emma Barnett and Simon Jack. And at 28 minutes to 9, we have a summary of the news with Tom Sanders.
Asylum seekers are to be banned from using taxpayer-funded taxis to get to medical appointments. An urgent review was launched by ministers after a BBC investigation found examples of the practice costing hundreds of pounds, including a 250-mile journey to see a GP. The Liberal Democrat MP Paul Kohler, who's a member of the Home Affairs Select Committee, told us he welcomed the ban, but said the real issue was the length of time taken by the government to process asylum seekers. Airlines are making urgent modifications to thousands of Airbus planes after the firm discovered intense solar radiation could interfere with onboard flight control computers. There have been warnings of disruption to services, although many carriers said they had already resolved the issue. Ukraine's foreign minister says two people have been killed after Russia launched dozens of missiles and hundreds of drones in an attack on the capital Kyiv. Loud explosions were heard across the city as a number of residential buildings were hit. 3 days of official mourning have begun in Hong Kong after a huge fire destroyed several tower blocks on Wednesday, killing at least 128 people. Around 200 others are still missing.
Thanks, Tom. Back in June, the House of Commons voted with a majority of 23 to pass the Terminally Ill Adults Bill, the End of Life Bill. It's now with the Lords, who've tabled around 1,000 amendments. Could be a record for any legislation. Peers have been given an extra 10 days now to scrutinise them. Is this a sensible level of scrutiny for what is an ethically polarising piece of very significant legislation, or is it an attempt to frustrate the passage of a controversial law? We should just remind you that terminally what it legislates for is terminally ill adults with fewer than 6 months to live can apply for an assisted death subject to approval by two doctors and a panel, including a lawyer, a psychiatrist and a social worker. In a moment, we'll talk to Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner, who is sponsoring the bill through the Lords. But let us first talk to Nikki DaCosta, former Director of Legislative Affairs at Number 10. And Nikki DaCosta, you think this bill is flawed, but Dame Esther Ranson, for example, who's been a campaigner on this, says this number of amendments is an attempt to sabotage democracy, is it?
Well, I'm not exactly sure on Dame Esther Ranson's credentials for legislative matters, but if we go into the detail, here we have society-changing legislation. The state authorised to end people's lives with lethal drugs, including on the NHS, not in a government manifesto for which there's no democratic mandate, no prior policy process, which is skeletal and leaves so much to ministerial discretion. And the peers are trying to balance The risk to every terminally ill person who may not have a genuine choice, who may be coerced or pressured, the disabled, those in poverty and abusive relationships, and those who truly get to autonomously choose, people like Esther Ranson, who are wealthy, independent, and who this threat doesn't occur for. And the Lords are doing a normal job. This bill is skeletal, and they're saying to the sponsors, like Lord Faulkner, it's not right not to put it on the face of the bill. So what they're trying to do is fill in the blanks. And this is really what's usual. The Lords typically takes 1.5 times the time the Commons take. So the Commons took 11 days in committee. You'd expect 16 for the Lords, and then half that again for a report stage. So what we're seeing is pretty normal for this kind of legislation, given that 500 peers were involved at second reading. I wouldn't really expect anything less. And don't take my word for it. Sir David Beamish, the lead clerk, former most senior clerk for the House of Lords, has confirmed there is no filibuster.
Well, the first part of your answer seems to suggest that actually also you are pretty opposed to this bill, and this is not just the normal amendment process. For example, I think most of these amendments came from 7 people in the Lords. There is one amendment, for example, that the person has provided a negative pregnancy test, and this applies to even to elderly men. This isn't amendment, this is blocking and filibustering.
So I think here, this example is a really good one, and you dismiss it. But there's a study by Jessica Kahn. She's one of the practitioners of assisted dying in the US. And they found that the younger the patient, the more the chance of complications and pain and deeply difficult situation and prolonged death, the younger the patient. Obviously, a pregnant woman is going to be in that younger cohort. Also, pregnant women process drugs differently. We know that. I've been pregnant. And one of the things. So if you are going to be saying this is a safe, curated death, then actually the implications of somebody being pregnant is relevant to the drug regime, even if you want to put aside the ethical.
But not if you're an elderly man.
But you'll know that in our legislation, we don't distinguish. We tend to neutral. So you could, and if I may, committee stage is about exploring the issues for the Lords. They hear the sponsor's response and they go away and look at there's no votes at committee stage usually in the Lords. They hear the sponsor's reassurance and they go away and say, am I reassured or do I get another, do I reword this? And they could take on board the kind of concern that you've just raised. But you've given a prime example where something superficially might be dismissed, but actually looks to a really important issue.
Yeah. Are you settling in for an extended game of ping pong on this? Are you in for the long haul?
Well, I am probably one of the few people that can say that they listen to every hour of the debate in the Commons. I would also say one of the things that Lord Faulkner will say, that there's hundreds of hours of debate. 2/3 of that time was spent debating a bill that no longer exists. It was with the High Court on it. All the written evidence and oral evidence taken in the Commons was on a bill with the High Court on it. So what we see is that when you talk to the number of hours of debate, it does not speak to the scrutiny of the bill, particularly when so many amendments were just smashed away. Rule of thumb, legislative strategy, two-house strategy. If you want the Lords to give you an easier ride, do more work in the Commons.
OK, well, let's put some of that to Charlie Faulkner, Lord Faulkner, who's here in the studio. This is very sensitive legislation. Let's admit that, right? Which is always going to face intense scrutiny.
And rightly so.
Important to get it right. This is reasonable scrutiny.
It's not. This is scrutiny that looks like a filibuster. Over 1,000 amendments, 7 people put them down. We've had 2 days in the Lords now at the committee stage. What the Lords does is they group amendments that are like each other together. And despite the fact there were 9 or 10 hours of debate, we got through in those 2 days 3 groups of amendments, which is incredibly slow. There's another bill in the Lords, just by way of example, called the Crime and Policing Bill, which is a very important bill. Lots of new offences will change the law for everybody over decades to come. It is 3 times the size of this bill, and it's got half the number of amendments. The amendments that are put down are often completely ridiculous. You cited the 65-year-old man who's got to give a pregnancy test. There's another amendment that says if you had a friend who committed a financial offence, then the Inland Revenue and the Financial Conduct Authority have got to approve your assisted dying request. There's another amendment.
Isn't that because there could be some nefarious financial reason for someone might be sort of coerced into taking a path of, you know, a certain course of action?
So if you had a friend who committed a criminal offence, the Financial Conduct Authority has got to approve your request. These things go way beyond scrutiny. We should be properly scrutinising. But you said, Simon, at the beginning, rightly, that the Commons has decided that there should be an assisted dying bill. It's not for a few members of the Lords to block it now. We've got to a point where after the first 2 days of the committee, the usual channels, that's the people who organise business of the Lords, have given us 10 more days. So hopefully that will mean people will be sensible.
Just on that other point that raised by Nikki DaCosta, it's not a government bill. It wasn't in the manifesto. There is no overwhelming public mandate to get this through.
Somebody's got to decide whether or not the nation changes to have an assisted dying bill. It should be the Commons. It couldn't be in any manifesto because it's a conscience issue. Therefore, no political party will put it into their manifesto, quite rightly. So who decides? Should it be the Commons or seven peers?
Nikki DaCosta, some thoughts from you?
Those peers, let me give you some examples of who they are. Baroness Holland, Royal College of Psychiatrists. Baroness Finlay, former head of the British Medical Association, renowned palliative care expert. Lord Sandhurst, former chair of the Bar Council. Baroness Grey Thompson, former Paralympian and campaigner for disabled people. Baroness Scotland, a former Attorney General. The list goes on. These are peers asking questions about their specialist subjects. They cannot be dismissed.
Serious people with serious objections?
Well, they're all against the bill in principle for a variety of reasons. There needs to be proper scrutiny. What's happening here is a few members of the Lords are arrogating to themselves the decision as to whether or not this nation should have an assisted dying bill.
Well, by definition, we seems like we have more to go on this story. Nikki DaCosta, former Director of Legislative Affairs at Number 10, Lord Charlie Falconer, thank you both.
It's 19 minutes to 9. Now to a truly heartwarming story of friendship, teenage promise and love, really. It's my personal story of the year. Georgia Barrington was just 15 when she was diagnosed with something called Meyer-Rokitansky-Kuster-Hauser syndrome, which is known as MRKH. It meant she was born without a womb and would not be able to carry her own child. Her best friend, Daisy Hope, there and then promised she would carry her baby for her when they were older, as Georgia still had her own ovaries. It was a promise neither of them gave that much more thought to. Despite her heartbreak post-diagnosis, Georgia continued with her professional dream to become a midwife. And amazingly, after she had her own baby, Daisy that is, she did stick to her word and become a surrogate for Georgia, for her best friend. I interviewed the friends on the programme, on the Today programme, earlier this year in July, as Daisy was pregnant with Georgia's baby, and we talked about the plan for delivery.
I'm taking my scrubs off. It wouldn't be right for me to provide the care because I've got too many things to think about. So one of my lovely colleagues and really close friend at work will kind of be looking after us, hopefully. But if everything's going well and it's looking like, you know, it's hopefully going to end in a lovely vaginal birth, then I'll pop some gloves on and hopefully... I mean, it would be rude not to catch my own baby when I've caught so
you
many
caught
others.
Mine first, yeah.
I did, yeah.
Daisy did have a baby before having George's, and she did indeed deliver it. And then we can tell you now what actually did happen.
To be honest, she didn't actually need delivering because she shot out onto the bed
in the
so quick. I had my one of
did
my.
Did you know you were having a girl?
No.
Okay, so she was a surprise.
So we didn't know. So the labour was a bit earlier than planned. We were 37 weeks, which is obviously considered term, and we went in. And one of the consultants that I know really well, she kind of walked in. I think she saw the stress on both of our faces, and she said, "Do you know what? Let's just get things. Should we break your waters now?" And me and Daisy were kind of like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! My partner doesn't even know we're here. Let's just take a step back." And she said, "Let's just induce you. What are we waiting for?"
It was such a roller coaster. It was the most magical, intense, scary, wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, because it felt like a long time.
It was a long time.
And the actual point of birth.
Yeah.
What happened?
I mean, it was all quite quick.
It was really quick. I mean, you push for about 20 minutes from start to finish and she was out. And,
was she given to you straight away?
Yeah, so she was out on the bed. She had all this dark hair and I just grabbed a towel and just wrapped. She came out a little bit stunned because I think it was a bit quick. And I was, you know, drying her all off and she had a little cry and I hadn't even looked what she was. I just kept her wrapped. So I kind of held her up and Daisy had a look. And I mean, everything's a bit swollen when they're first born. So I think she was a bit like, is it a girl? And then that moment of you telling us it was a girl was just...
said, it's a girl, George.
It was just magical,
and
yeah.
And we were both like...
yeah, everyone. I mean, as soon as I saw her head, like when Daisy was pushing, I absolutely lost it, which meant Claire, who was our midwife, lost it. So she probably couldn't see really what she was doing.
I said, stop crying. If I start crying, there's no chance I'm getting this baby out.
And my partner kind of just sat scared but excited.
We were all there, though. My partner was
there. Yeah, your part. I was so glad everyone was there because Ollie's been a massive part of it, you know. I don't think Daisy could have got through it without Ollie. You know, he was such a support. And so to have all of us there, it was just amazing.
It was funny because I said the one thing, you know, leaving Amelia, I'd not had one night away from Amelia her entire life until the day we were in Duke.
And how old was she when you were?
So she's three and, she's yeah. three and a half. Okay. So, you know, I'd gone off to work that morning. Bye, love you, see you later. To suddenly, oh, okay, we're giving birth. Like, there is, you know, when am I going to be home? And then it wasn't until we realised, great, I've progressed. It's not going to be a C-section. This is going to be a natural birth. That I thought, right, I can get to her concert on the Thursday. I was like, I'm going to be there. I'm going to make sure that I am at her Harvest Festival concert watching her sing. And they're all thinking, no, you're not.
Yeah, the midwives
no
are like,
way.
Come on, let's just be a bit realistic about this.
So 4:59, baby pops out. 2:30, I'm sat on the church pew.
You did it.
I did it.
It's kind of crazy what you can do after birth sometimes.
When you're a mum, though, because it's that mum in you. I had to be with my daughter once, giving George her daughter. So
I did pick up the next day with my son.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't look great walking in, I'm going to be honest.
It was funny, not that the mum,
everyone can... Oh, no. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, no, it
wow.
was... maybe it was 36 hours later, to be fair. But it, I don't know. It can motivate you in slightly full-on ways. And you're now in this situation. I mean, you are very newly... a mum because of your best friend. How, you know, it's a big, I mean, it's a big change for
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
But just,
I just feel so lucky. You know, when I think back to, I wish I could picture this and give it to that 15-year-old me sat in that GP surgery, because now, even though, you know, I see and I think, oh, it would be lovely to be pregnant, I would not change this. Like, no one else will ever have what we have had. Like, no one else will be able to tell stories of how their daughter came into the world in this way, and I just feel so lucky, and every time I look at her, I just I'm so grateful.
Ottilie's a lovely name as well.
Thank you.
Doing this, having fulfilled the mission, is that how it feels a bit? Is there sort of a sense of purpose about it?
Yeah, I feel like my purpose is complete. Like, that's genuinely, like, when I think about it, it's so weird. You go through the pregnancy, you go through the birth, and then you recover without a baby. But because I've done this wonderful thing, and it's the first time in my entire life, other than having Amelia, that I feel so proud of myself. And I'm so pleased that I am a strong person and I could get through it. And I did it for my friend. And that's, like, the best thing I will ever achieve, I think.
You can hear that conversation, and it is lovely, in full with Georgia and Daisy. There were lots more twists and turns during their incredible journey, exclusively on my podcast, Ready to Talk, which tells the biggest stories that have reshaped people's lives. Available now on BBC Sounds or wherever you like to download your pods.
12 minutes to nine, Your Party. That's the name of the new party founded and led by Jeremy Corbyn and Zara Sultana. It's got its launch conference today in Liverpool. The new left-wing party's early days have been pretty rocky, fallouts, fractious social media exchanges. But the plan this weekend is to settle some of those things, like a name, a leadership structure and a constitution. And what impact will they have on the UK political landscape? Gabriel Pogrand is the Whitehall editor of the Sunday Times. Good morning, Gabriel. What are they trying to achieve and how big an impact can they have?
So this is a period of radical reimagination on the left. I mean, there's a lot of diversity of thought as to where the left ought to go from here. You know, does it remain in the Labour Party? If not, who is the standard bearer of kind of radical Corbynite politics? Is it Jeremy Corbyn himself? Is it Zara Sultana, the Coventry South MP, alongside him? Is it the Green Party? You know, for most of this year, people would have said Corbyn's likely, after winning his Islington North seat and forming this independent alliance in Parliament, that he was likely to be the kind of tip of the spear. But because of the kind of personal squabbles and infighting that have characterised this party since its launch, which, by the way, took place without Corbyn's blessing or permission, it looks now like your party has a big fight on its hands to reclaim the mantle of being that left party. And that's the objective of this weekend's inaugural conference. They want to they want to vote on a name. They want to vote on not necessarily who's leading, but at least what model of leadership they're going to adopt. And and that's essentially the concept. They're trying to re-establish a bit of unity in what has been a quite bewilderingly fraught first few months.
Yeah, I understand that one of them wasn't invited to the other one's party last night or something. It's not getting off to a very good start.
Well, there have been parallel rallies. So there was a Corbyn rally and a Sultana address. And I think that, you know, the fact they fall into these different camps, I mean, part of it's personal. There are some underlying ideological tensions as well. Sultana is seeking to style herself as the most forthrightly anti-Zionist, anti-Israel politician. And there were some leaflets circulating in around the conference in Liverpool yesterday accusing Corbyn of being inadequately opposed to the Jewish state's policies in Gaza and too pro two states rather than kind of one single state. So these are the sort of some of the minutiae that do tend to animate left politics and which are sort of possibly providing a bit of underlying ideological context to some of the personal squabbles.
All right, Gabriel, we will see what emerges as they go into their cocoon phase and see what emerges from that after the weekend. Gabriel Pogrom there, Whitehall editor of The Times.
And at 9:09, I'll remind us it is Saturday. We do get to take a few moments, even on the Today programme, just to take a step back from the 24-hour news machine and take stock of the week that was and the big stories that perhaps we should see in a wider context. Joining us to help us do that, Rachel Sylvester, political editor of The Observer. Good morning.
Morning.
And Gillian Tett, Financial Times columnist and provost of King's College, Cambridge. Hello, Gillian.
Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. And I have to start, I mean, it's a story in and of itself, and of course Simon's been talking about it already this morning, but it's very striking, this idea. I mean, if you just look at the Daily Mail's front page, Lia Reeves must go now. She knew there was no black hole in the public finances, but kept it secret to hike taxes in Benefit Street budget. That is how it's being put in the week that was, Rachel Sylvester.
Well, the chaos hasn't ended, has it? You know, this was the most sort of extraordinarily chaotic build-up to the budget. And now the kind of fallout from the budget seems to be equally confusing. And I think this is damaging for Rachel Rees because the OBR are saying that when she made that dramatic breakfast time cheerio speech about everything was all a total disaster, which was seen as paving the way for income tax rises. In fact, according to the OBR, she knew that it wasn't. There wasn't this huge black hole. And I think it just shows, which actually I thought all along was the case, that this was a political decision to back away from the income tax rises. They basically bottled it. They thought, we don't have the authority. Keir Starmer thought he didn't have the authority with his backbenchers to get such a controversial manifesto-breaking tax rise through. So I think it sort of highlights the, if you like, the weakness of the Prime Minister and then by implication the Chancellor too.
Gillian Tett, though, you know, Chancellor reveals things weren't quite as bad as they let on beforehand. This pitch rolling has been done as long as there have been budgets, hasn't it?
Yes, it's basically called politics. Now, this does look rather like an omni-shambles, to use that wonderful word, both before the budget and now. And it's certainly very embarrassing. And yes, it does undermine some of Rachel Reeves' authority. However, the good news, and I would stress this as being good news, is that the bond markets haven't revolted. You haven't had a dramatic financial markets reaction as you saw before. And that's really been top of the mind of the current government because it was so damaging last time. So that is the good news. And that's largely because Rachel Reeves built this big buffer or rainy day, if you like, fund for the future that she can use to guard against any unexpected shocks. Mm. And the other bit of good news, if you like, is that it does seem that she's managed to buy off some of the left-wing rebellion around what she's done on the two-child cap and things like that. So those are the crumbs of comfort. But in terms of the omni-shambles and the undermining of confidence and credibility, and also, frankly, the most important thing, the lack of any growth-boosting measures in this budget, yeah, that's the bad news.
And Rachel, if I could just ask another question on that. You say the bond markets have been assuaged. She's bought them off, if you like, with this big headroom. There are some pretty heroic assumptions, though, about spending in the second half of this budget, which some people say are a bit unrealistic. It's tax now and spend later. And I just wonder whether people believe that, you know, as you approach the next election, she's going to do some of the things she's promised to do.
Yeah, I think there were three audiences, weren't there, for this budget. There was the bond market, as Gillian said. There were the Labour MPs. Both of those were bought off with different angles, the headroom and the two-child cap. But the third audience, and in a way the most important one politically, were the voters. Mm. And, you know, what do they think of this budget? And when it goes into an election, will they feel richer or poorer? And we've got a poll for this weekend in the Observer's showing only 11% think their personal finances will be better as a result of this budget. So I think for the Labour MPs going back to their constituencies this weekend, they may find actually not quite the sort of cheering that they were hoping for.
Yes. Yeah, well, but also, I mean, is anyone happy, you know, in the country? I mean, I know that budgets aren't these, I mean, Simon, you'll know this, they're not moments of everybody talking to each other in a warm way ever, but as they analyse it, but there is this feeling. And then, you know, she seemed terribly unhappy at times, even saying to the Times, stop mansplaining to me. And then you've had this, you know, I just thought you could comment, Rachel, and maybe Gillian as well, but just this sight of two women at the dispatch box rowing over whether you're a terrible politician or you're a terrible woman or both.
Yeah, I thought Kemi Badenoch just actually came across as really mean, and the way she attacked Rachel Reeves, she called it whining and sort of went for her very personally, whereas actually there's quite a lot you could have criticised her for in this budget. The lack of a sort of really big picture reforms, you know, not doing anything on the pension triple lock, not doing anything on welfare reform, without actually getting personal. I thought,
although she did bring up mansplaining herself, that I suppose that was what Kemi hooked it to.
Yeah, but I thought it would have been more dignified and more, you know, politics shouldn't just be about personal attacks, or shouldn't actually be about personal attacks. It should be about political argument. And there was lots to debate in this budget without going for the personal.
We only have very little time left, but Gillian, I'm going to really change gear because I want to talk about marijuana and Thanksgiving. I think we need a bit of that. Not me personally, now.
That's not Radio 4's policy.
Rachel's face was enough of a picture.
Yeah, I thought I was going to talk about the bond market again.
Yeah. Let's get you on something else for a change.
I was asked to find an entirely different story that might be a bit out of the box. Basically, I was currently going to say, for anyone who's American, there's just been Thanksgiving in America on Thursday, and one of the big new trends in America is what they call being California sober, which means not drinking alcohol, but actually partaking in marijuana, which of course is legal in much of America. And so not only have you got marijuana stores popping up all over the country, you've got people adding marijuana to, you know, gravy for the turkey Thanksgiving dinner and all kinds of things. The famous so-called cousin's walk, which happens at Thanksgiving when the younger generation go off for a walk and partake. But it's really become quite a sort of cultural thing. And the important thing is that it means that alcohol sales are falling quite sharply in parts of America, which is hitting the drinks industry overall.
A position for the budget to consider, I'm sure.
It's interesting you're saying that it's hitting drink sales, because one of the things that's been very interesting to me from a financial point of view is that weight loss jabs, for example, are having a massive impact on the food industry. They're actually eating their lunch, basically, the pharma industry. And so it's interesting to see how different industries respond.
Well, this is, again, one of the reasons why, again, drink sales are in trouble, is partly because of the rise of weight loss drug and jabs, which are reducing cravings. And I guess one of the points is simply that fashions change. I'm trained as a cultural anthropologist here at Cambridge, and fashions change over time, and what we think is normal and inevitable and unchanging almost never is.
Well, even
for holidays.
Some suggestion for unadulterated joy for some there, especially on the stateside and how things are changing. But Rachel, I suppose, just to come to the future for Rachel Reeves, there does seem to be, you know, the political future here. There does seem to be doubt over it or not. What's your reading?
I think Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer's futures are completely entwined. And what cabinet ministers were saying to me last week was, you know, this budget doesn't actually change anything. In the end, it'll come down to May, and I think it's still looking very tricky for them both.
It was interesting because we were told this was going to be an absolutely existential budget, one of the most important budgets ever. There was quite a lot of drum roll up to this one, and then you sort of come out of the air raid shelter politically the next day, and all the buildings are still there, and there they both are.
I think that's what's interesting, that actually it didn't live up to that hype on any angle. And I think that might be a problem. It wasn't a reforming budget, one former cabinet minister said to me. It was a